Chapter 1. I wish either my father or my mother, or indeed both of them, as they were in duty both equally bound to it, had minded what they were about when they begot me, had they duly considered how much depended upon what they were then doing, that not only the production of a rational being was concerned in it, but that possibly the happy formation and temperature of his body, perhaps his genius and the very cast of his mind, and, for aught they knew to the contrary, even the fortunes of his whole house might take their turn from the humors and dispositions which were then uppermost, had they duly weighed and considered all this, and proceeded accordingly, I am verily persuaded I should have made a quite different figure in the world, from that in which the reader is likely to see me. Believe me, good folks, this is not so inconsiderable a thing as many of you may think it. You have all, I dare say, heard of the animal spirits, as how they are transfused from father to son, and see. And a great deal to that purpose. Well, you may take my word, that 9 parts in 10 of a man's sense or his nonsense, his successes and miscarriages in this world depend upon their motions and activity, and the different tracks and trains you put them into, so that when they are once set a-going, whether right or wrong, 'tis not a halfpenny matter, away they go cluttering like hay go mad, and by treading the same steps over and over again, they presently make a road of it, as plain and as smooth as a garden walk, which, when they are once used to, the devil himself sometimes shall not be able to drive them off it. Pray, my dear, quoth my mother, have you not forgot to wind up the clock? Good G! Cried my father, making an exclamation, but taking care to moderate his voice at the same time, did ever woman, since the creation of the world, interrupt a man with such a silly question? Pray, what was your father saying?
Nothing.
Chapter 1. 2. Then, positively, there is nothing in the question that I can see, either good or bad. Then, let me tell you, sir, it was a very unseasonable question at least, because it scattered and dispersed the animal spirits, whose business it was to have escorted and gone hand in hand with the homunculus, and conducted him safe to the place destined for his reception. The homunculus, sir, in however low and ludicrous a light he may appear, in this age of levity, to the eye of folly or prejudice, to the eye of reason and scientific research, he stands confessed he being guarded and circumscribed with rites. The minutest philosophers, who by the by, have the most enlarged understandings, their souls being inversely as their inquiries, show us incontestably, that the homunculus is created by the same hand, engendered in the same course of nature, endowed with the same locomotive powers and faculties with us, that he consists as we do, of skin, hair, fat, flesh, veins, arteries, ligaments, nerves, cartilages, bones, marrow, brains, glands, genitals, humors, and articulations, is a being of as much activity, and in all senses of the word, as much and as truly our fellow creature as my Lord Chancellor of England. He may be benefited, he may be injured, he may obtain redress, in a word, he has all the claims and rights of humanity, which Tully, Puffendorf, or the best ethic writers allow to arise out of that state and relation. Now, dear sir, what if any accident had befallen him in his way alone? Or that through terror of it, natural to so young a traveller, my little gentleman had got to his journey's end miserably spent, his muscular strength and virility worn down to a thread, his own animal spirits ruffled beyond description, and that in this sad disordered state of nerves, he had lain down a prey to sudden starts, or a series of melancholy dreams and fancies, for 9 long months together. I tremble to think what a foundation had been laid for 1,000 weaknesses both of body and mind, which no skill of the physician or the philosopher could ever afterwards have set thoroughly to rights.
Chapter 1.
3. To my uncle Mr. Toby Shandy do I stand indebted for the preceding anecdote, to whom my father, who was an excellent natural philosopher, and much given to close reasoning upon the smallest matters, had oft, and heavily complained of the injury, but once more particularly, as my uncle Toby well remembered, upon his observing a most unaccountable obliquity, as he called it, in my manner of setting up my top, and justifying the principles upon which I had done it, the old gentleman shook his head, and in a tone more expressive by half of sorrow than reproach, he said his heart all along foreboded, and he saw it verified in this, and from 1,000 other observations he had made upon me, that I should neither think nor act like any other man's child. But alas! Continued he, shaking his head a second time, and wiping away a tear which was trickling down his cheeks, my Tristram's misfortunes began 9 months before ever he came into the world. My mother, who was sitting by, looked up, but she knew no more than her backside what my father meant, but my uncle, Mr. Toby Shandy, who had been often informed of the affair, understood him very well.
Chapter 1.
4. I know there are readers in the world, as well as many other good people in it, who are no readers at all, who find themselves ill at ease, unless they are let into the whole secret from first to last, of everything which concerns you. It is in pure compliance with this humor of theirs, and from a backwardness in my nature to disappoint any one soul living, that I have been so very particular already. As my life and opinions are likely to make some noise in the world, and, if I conjecture right, will take in all ranks, professions, and denominations of men whatever, be no less read than the Pilgrim's Progress itself and in the end, prove the very thing which Montaigne dreaded his essays should turn out, that is, a book for a parlor window, I find it necessary to consult everyone a little in his turn, and therefore must beg pardon for going on a little farther in the same way, for which cause, right glad I am, that I have begun the history of myself in the way I have done, and that I am able to go on, tracing everything in it, as Horace says, ab ovo. Horace, I know, does not recommend this fashion altogether, but that gentleman is speaking only of an epic poem or a tragedy, I forget which, besides, if it was not so, I should beg Mr. Horace's pardon, for in writing what I have said about, I shall confine myself neither to his rules, nor to any man's rules that ever lived. To such however as do not choose to go so far back into these things, I can give no better advice than that they skip over the remaining part of this chapter, for I declare beforehand, 'tis wrote only for the curious and inquisitive. Shut the door. Dash. I was begot in the night betwixt the first Sunday and the first Monday in the month of March, in the year of our Lord 1718. I am positive I was. But how I came to be so very particular in my account of a thing which happened before I was born, is owing to another small anecdote known only in our own family, but now made public for the better clearing up this point. My father, you must know, who was originally a Turkey merchant, but had left off business for some years, in order to retire to, and die upon, his paternal estate in the county of Dash, was, I believe, one of the most regular men in everything he did, whether 'twas matter of business, or matter of amusement, that ever lived. As a small specimen of this extreme exactness of his, to which he was in truth a slave, he had made it a rule for many years of his life, on the first Sunday night of every month throughout the whole year, as certain as ever the Sunday night came, to wind up a large house clock, which we had standing on the backstairs head, with his own hands, and being somewhere between 50 and 60 years of age at the time I have been speaking of, he had likewise gradually brought some other little family concernments to the same period, in order, as he would often say to my uncle Toby, to get them all out of the way at one time, and be no more plagued and pestered with them the rest of the month. It was attended but with one misfortune, which, in a great measure, fell upon myself, and the effects of which I fear I shall carry with me to my grave, namely, that from an unhappy association of ideas, which have no connection in nature, it so fell out at length, that my poor mother could never hear the said clock wound up, but the thoughts of some other things unavoidably popped into her head and vice versa, which strange combination of ideas, the sagacious Locke, who certainly understood the nature of these things better than most men, affirms to have produced more reactions than all other sources of prejudice whatsoever. But this by the by. Now it appears by a memorandum in my father's pocketbook, which now lies upon the table, that on Lady Day, which was on the 25th of the same month in which I date my geniture, my father set upon his journey to London, with my eldest brother Bobby, to fix him at Westminster School, and, as it appears from the same authority, that he did not get down to his wife and family till the second week in May following, it brings the thing almost to a certainty. However, what follows in the beginning of the next chapter, puts it beyond all possibility of a doubt. But pray, sir, what was your father doing all December, January, and February? Why, madam, he was all that time afflicted with a sciatica. Chapter 1. V. On the 5th day of November, 1718, which to the era fixed on, was as near 9 calendar months as any husband could in reason have expected, was I Tristram Shandy, gentleman, brought forth into this scurvy and disastrous world of ours. I wish I had been born in the moon, or in any of the planets, except Jupiter or Saturn, because I never could bear cold weather, for it could not well have fared worse with me in any of them, though I will not answer for Venus, than it has in this vile, dirty planet of ours, which, on my conscience, with reverence be it spoken, I take to be made up of the shreds and clippings of the rest. Not but the planet is well enough, provided a man could be born in it to a great title or to a great estate, or could anyhow contrive to be called up to public charges, and employments of dignity or power, but that is not my case, and therefore every man will speak of the fair as his own market has gone in it, for which cause I affirm it over again to be one of the vilest worlds that ever was made, for I can truly say, that from the first hour I drew my breath in it, to this, that I can now scarce draw it at all, for an asthma I got in skating against the wind in Flanders, I have been the continual sport of what the world calls fortune, and though I will not wrong her by saying, she has ever made me feel the weight of any great or signal evil, yet with all the good temper in the world I affirm it of her, that in every stage of my life, and at every turn and corner where she could get fairly at me, the ungracious Duchess has pelted me with a set of as pitiful misadventures and cross accidents as ever small hero sustained. Chapter 1. Fie. In the beginning of the last chapter, I informed you exactly when I was born, but I did not inform you how. No, that particular was reserved entirely for a chapter by itself. Besides, sir, as you and I are in a manner perfect strangers to each other, it would not have been proper to have let you into too many circumstances relating to myself all at once. You must have a little patience. I have undertaken, you see, to write not only my life, but my opinions also, hoping and expecting that your knowledge of my character, and of what kind of a mortal I am, by the one, would give you a better relish for the other, as you proceed farther with me, the slight acquaintance, which is now beginning betwixt us, will grow into familiarity, and that unless one of us is in fault, will terminate in friendship. Odium preclarum. Then nothing which has touched me will be thought trifling in its nature, or tedious in its telling. Therefore, my dear friend and companion, if you should think me somewhat sparing of my narrative on my first setting out, bear with me, and let me go on, and tell my story my own way, or, if I should seem now and then to trifle upon the road, or should sometimes put on a fool's cap with a bell to it, for a moment or two as we pass along, don't fly off, but rather courteously give me credit for a little more wisdom than appears upon my outside, and as we jog on, either laugh with me, or at me, or in short do anything, only keep your temper. Chapter 1. 7. In the same village where my father and my mother dwelt also a thin, upright, motherly, notable, good old body of a midwife, who with the help of a little plain good sense, and some years full employment in her business, in which she had all along trusted little to her own efforts, and a great deal to those of Dame Nature, had acquired, in her way, no small degree of reputation in the world, by which word world, need I in this place inform your worship, that I would be understood to mean no more of it, than a small circle described upon the circle of the great world, of 4 English miles diameter, or thereabouts, of which the cottage where the good old woman lived is supposed to be the center. She had been left, it seems, a widow in great distress, with 3 or 4 small children, in her 47th year, and as she was at that time a person of decent carriage, grave deportment, a woman moreover of few words and withal an object of compassion, whose distress, and silence under it, called out the louder for a friendly lift, the wife of the parson of the parish was touched with pity, and having often lamented an inconvenience to which her husband's flock had for many years been exposed, inasmuch as there was no such thing as a midwife, of any kind or degree, to be got at, let the case have been never so urgent, within less than 6 or 7 long miles riding, which said 7 long miles in dark nights and dismal roads, the country thereabouts being nothing but a deep clay, was almost equal to 14, and that in effect was sometimes next to having no midwife at all, it came into her head, that it would be doing as seasonable a kindness to the whole parish, as to the poor creature herself, to get her a little instructed in some of the plain principles of the business, in order to set her up in it. As no woman thereabouts was better qualified to execute the plan she had formed than herself, the gentlewoman very charitably undertook it, and having great influence over the female part of the parish, she found no difficulty in effecting it to the utmost of her wishes. In truth, the parson joined his interest with his wife's in the whole affair, and in order to do things as they should be, and give the poor soul as good a title by law to practice, as his wife had given by institution, he cheerfully paid the fees for the ordinary's license himself, amounting in the whole, to the sum of 18 shillings and 4 pence, so that betwixt them both, the good woman was fully invested in the real and corporal possession of her office, together with all its rights, members, and appurtenances whatsoever. These last words, you must know, were not according to the old form in which such licenses, faculties, and powers usually ran, which in like cases had heretofore been granted to the sisterhood. But it was according to a neat formula of Didius his own devising, who having a particular turn for taking to pieces, and new framing over again all kind of instruments in that way, not only hit upon this dainty amendment, but coaxed many of the old licensed matrons in the neighborhood, to open their faculties afresh, in order to have the swam wham of his inserted. I own I never could envy Didius in these kinds of fancies of his, but every man to his own taste. Did not Dr. Cunastrocius, that great man, at his leisure hours, take the greatest delight imaginable in combing of asses' tails, and plucking the dead hairs out with his teeth, though he had tweezers always in his pocket? Nay, if you come to that, sir, have not the wisest of men in all ages, not excepting Solomon himself, have they not had their hobby horses, their running horses, their coins and their cockle shells, their drums and their trumpets, their fiddles, their pallets, their maggots and their butterflies? And so long as a man rides his hobby horse peaceably and quietly along the king's highway, and neither compels you or me to get up behind him, pray, sir, what have either you or I to do with it? Chapter 1. 8. De gustibus non est disputandum, that is, there is no disputing against hobby horses, and for my part, I seldom do, nor could I with any sort of grace, had I been an enemy to them at the bottom, for happening, at certain intervals and changes of the moon, to be both fiddler and painter, according as the fly stings, be it known to you, that I keep a couple of pads myself, upon which, in their turns, nor do I care who knows it, I frequently ride out and take the air, though sometimes, to my shame be it spoken, I take somewhat longer journeys than what a wise man would think altogether right. But the truth is, I am not a wise man, and besides I'm a mortal of so little consequence in the world, it is not much matter what I do, so I seldom fret or fume at all about it, nor does it much disturb my rest, when I see such great lords and tall personages as hereafter follow, such, for instance, as my Lord A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, and so on, all of a row, mounted upon their several horses, some with large stirrups, getting on in a more grave and sober pace, others on the contrary, tucked up to their very chins, with whips across their mouths, scouring and scampering it away like so many little party-colored devils astride a mortgage, and as if some of them were resolved to break their necks. So much the better, say I to myself, for in case the worst should happen, the world will make a shift to do excellently well without them, and for the rest, why Godspeed them e'en let them ride on without opposition from me, for were their lordships and horse this very night 'tis 10 to 1 but that many of them would be worse mounted by one half before tomorrow morning. Not one of these instances therefore can be said to break in upon my rest. But there is an instance, which I own puts me off my guard, and that is, when I see one born for great actions, and what is still more for his honor, whose nature ever inclines him to good ones, when I behold such a one, my lord, like yourself, whose principles and conduct are as generous and noble as his blood, and whom, for that reason, a corrupt world cannot spare one moment, when I see such a one, my lord, mounted, though it is but for a minute beyond the time which my love to my country has prescribed to him, and my zeal for his glory wishes, then, my lord, I cease to be a philosopher, and in the first transport of an honest impatience, I wish the hobby horse, with all his fraternity, at the devil. My lord, I maintain this to be a dedication, notwithstanding its singularity in the three great essentials of matter, form and place, I beg, therefore, you will accept it as such, and that you will permit me to lay it, with the most respectful humility, at your lordship's feet when you are upon them, which you can be when you please, and that is, my lord, whenever there is occasion for it, and I will add, to the best purposes too. I have the honor to be, my lord, your lordship's most obedient, and most devoted, and most humble servant, Tristram Shandy. Chapter 1. 9. I solemnly declare to all mankind, that the above dedication was made for no one prince, prelate, pope, or potentate, duke, marquis, earl, viscount, or baron, of this, or any other realm in Christendom, nor has it yet been hawked about, or offered publicly or privately, directly or indirectly, to any one person or personage, great or small, but is honestly a true virgin dedication untried on, upon any soul living. I labor this point so particularly, merely to remove any offense or objection which might arise against it from the manner in which I propose to make the most of it, which is the putting it up fairly to public sale, which I now do. Every author has a way of his own in bringing his points to bear. For my own part, as I hate chaffering and higgling for a few guineas in a dark country, I resolved within myself, from the very beginning, to deal squarely and openly with your great folks in this affair, and try whether I should not come off the better by it. If therefore there is any one duke, marquis, earl, viscount, or baron, in these His Majesty's dominions, who stands in need of a tight, genteel dedication, and whom the above will suit, for by the by, unless it suits in some degree, I will not part with it, it is much at his service for 50 guineas, which I am positive is 20 guineas less than it ought to be afforded for, by any man of genius. My lord, if you examine it over again, it is far from being a gross piece of daubing, as some dedications are. The design, your lordship sees, is good, the coloring transparent, the drawing not amiss, or to speak more like a man of science, and measure my piece in the painter's scale, divided into 20, I believe, my lord, the outlines will turn out as 12, the composition as 9, the coloring as 6, the expression 13.5, and the design, if I may be allowed, my lord, to understand my own design, and supposing absolute perfection in designing, to be as 20, I think it cannot well fall short of 19. Besides all this, there is keeping in it, and the dark strokes in the hobby horse, which is a secondary figure, and a kind of background to the whole, give great force to the principal lights in your own figure, and make it come off wonderfully, and besides, there is an air of originality in the tout ensemble. Be pleased, my good lord, to order the sum to be paid into the hands of Mr. Dodsley, for the benefit of the author, and in the next edition care shall be taken that this chapter be expunged, and your lordship's titles, distinctions, arms, and good actions, be placed at the front of the preceding chapter, all which, from the words, de gustibus non est disputandum, and whatever else in this book relates to hobby horses, but no more, shall stand dedicated to your lordship. The rest I dedicate to the moon, who, by the by, of all the patrons or matrons I can think of, has most power to set my book a-going, and make the world run mad after it. Bright goddess, if thou art not too busy with Candid and Miss Kunigan's affairs, take Tristram Shandy's under thy protection also. Zero Chapter 1. X. Whatever degree of small merit the act of benignity in favor of the midwife might justly claim, or in whom that claim truly rested, at first sight seems not very material to this history, certain however it was, that the gentlewoman, the parson's wife, did run away at that time with the whole of it, and yet, for my life, I cannot help thinking but that the parson himself, though he had not the good fortune to hit upon the design first, yet, as he heartily concurred in it the moment it was laid before him, and as heartily parted with his money to carry it into execution, had a claim to some share of it, if not to a full half of whatever honor was due to it. The world at that time was pleased to determine the matter otherwise. Lay down the book, and I will allow you half a day to give a probable guess at the grounds of this procedure. Be it known then, that, for about 5 years before the date of the midwife's license, of which you have had so circumstantial an account, the parson we have to do with had made himself a country talk by a breach of all decorum, which he had committed against himself, his station, and his office, and that was in never appearing better, or otherwise mounted, than upon a lean, sorry, jackass of a horse, value about £1.15, who, to shorten all description of him, was full brother to Rosinante, as far as similitude congenial could make him, for he answered his description to a hair breadth in everything, except that I do not remember 'tis anywhere said, that Rosinante was broken-winded, and that, moreover, Rosinante, as is the happiness of most Spanish horses, fat or lean, was undoubtedly a horse at all points. I know very well that the hero's horse was a horse of chaste deportment, which may have given grounds for the contrary opinion, but it is as certain at the same time that Rosinante's continency, as may be demonstrated from the adventure of the Yangtzean carriers, proceeded from no bodily defect or cause whatsoever, but from the temperance and orderly current of his blood. And let me tell you, madam, there is a great deal of very good chastity in the world, in behalf of which you could not say more for your life. Let that be as it may, as my purpose is to do exact justice to every creature brought upon the stage of this dramatic work, I could not stifle this distinction in favor of Don Quixote's horse. In all other points, the parson's horse, I say, was just such another, for he was as lean, and as lank, and as sorry a jade, as humility herself could have bestrided. In the estimation of here and there a man of weak judgment, it was greatly in the parson's power to have helped the figure of this horse of his, for he was master of a very handsome demi-peaked saddle, quilted on the seat with green plush, garnished with a double row of silver-headed studs, and a noble pair of shining brass stirrups, with a housing altogether suitable, of grey superfine cloth, with an edging of black lace, terminating in a deep, black, silk fringe, poudre d'or, all which he had purchased in the pride and prime of his life, together with a grand embossed bridle, ornamented at all points as it should be. But not caring to banter his beast, he had hung all these up behind his study door, and, in lieu of them, had seriously befitted him with just such a bridle and such a saddle, as the figure and value of such a steed might well and truly deserve. In the several sallies about his parish, and in the neighboring visits to the gentry who lived around him, you will easily comprehend, that the parson, so appointed, would both hear and see enough to keep his philosophy from rusting. To speak the truth, he never could enter a village, but he caught the attention of both old and young. Labor stood still as he passed the bucket hung suspended in the middle of the well. The spinning wheel forgot its round. Even Chuck Farthing and Shufflecap themselves stood gaping till he had got out of sight, and as his movement was not of the quickest, he had generally time enough upon his hands to make his observations, to hear the groans of the serious, and the laughter of the light-hearted, all which he bore with excellent tranquility. His character was, he loved a jest in his heart, and as he saw himself in the true point of ridicule, he would say he could not be angry with others for seeing him in a light, in which he so strongly saw himself, so that to his friends, who knew his foible was not the love of money, and who therefore made the less scruple in bannering the extravagance of his humor, instead of giving the true cause, he chose rather to join in the laugh against himself, and as he never carried one single ounce of flesh upon his own bones, being altogether as spare a figure as his beast, he would sometimes insist upon it, that the horse was as good as the rider deserved, that they were, centaur-like, both of a piece. At other times, and in other moods, when his spirits were above the temptation of false wit, he would say, he found himself going off fast in a consumption, and, with great gravity, would pretend, he could not bear the sight of a fat horse, without a dejection of heart, and a sensible alteration in his pulse, and that he had made choice of the lean one he rode upon, not only to keep himself in countenance, but in spirits. At different times he would give 50 humorous and apposite reasons for riding a meek-spirited jade of a broken-winded horse, preferably to one of metal, for on such a one he could sit mechanically, and meditate as delightfully divanitate mundi et fugus aeculi, as with the advantage of a death's head before him, that, in all other exercitations, he could spend his time, as he rode slowly along, to as much account as in his study, that he could draw up an argument in his sermon, or a hole in his breeches, as steadily on the one as in the other, that brisk trotting and slow argumentation, like wit and judgment, were two incompatible movements. But that upon his steed he could unite and reconcile everything, he could compose his sermon, he could compose his cough, and, in case nature gave a call that way, he could likewise compose himself to sleep. In short, the parson upon such encounters would assign any cause but the true cause, and he withheld the true one, only out of a nicety of temper, because he thought it did honor to him. But the truth of the story was as follows: in the first years of this gentleman's life, and about the time when the superb saddle and bridle were purchased by him, it had been his manner, or vanity, or call it what you will, to run into the opposite extreme. In the language of the county where he dwelt, he was said to have loved a good horse, and generally had one of the best in the whole parish standing in his stable always ready for saddling, and as the nearest midwife, as I told you, did not live nearer to the village than 7 miles, and in a vile country, it so fell out that the poor gentleman was scarce a whole week together without some piteous application for his beast, and as he was not an unkind-hearted man, and every case was more pressing and more distressful than the last, as much as he loved his beast, he had never a heart to refuse him, the upshot of which was generally this, that his horse was either clapped, or spavined, or grazed, or he was twitter-bond, or broken-winded, or something, in short, or other had befallen him, which would let him carry no flesh, so that he had every 9 or 10 months a bad horse to get rid of, and a good horse to purchase in his stead. What the loss in such a balance might amount to, communibus sanus, I would leave to a special jury of sufferers in the same traffic, to determine, but let it be what it would, the honest gentleman bore it for many years without a murmur, till at length, by repeated ill accidents of the kind, he found it necessary to take the thing under consideration, and upon weighing the whole, and summing it up in his mind, he found it not only disproportioned to his other expenses, but withal so heavy an article in itself, as to disable him from any other act of generosity in his parish. Besides this, he considered that with half the sum thus galloped away, he could do 10 times as much good, and what still weighed more with him than all other considerations put together, was this, that it confined all his charity into one particular channel, and where, as he fancied, it was the least wanted, namely, to the child-bearing and child-getting part of his parish, reserving nothing for the impotent, nothing for the aged, nothing for the many comfortless scenes he was hourly called forth to visit, where poverty, and sickness and affliction dwelled together. For these reasons he resolved to discontinue the expense, and there appeared but 2 possible ways to extricate him clearly out of it, and these were, either to make it an irrevocable law never more to lend his steed upon any application whatever, or else be content to ride the last poor devil, such as they had made him, with all his aches and infirmities, to the very end of the chapter. As he dreaded his own constancy in the first, he very cheerfully betook himself to the second, and though he could very well have explained it, as I said, to his honor, yet, for that very reason, he had a spirit above it, choosing rather to bear the contempt of his enemies, and the laughter of his friends, than undergo the pain of telling a story, which might seem a panegyric upon himself. I have the highest idea of the spiritual and refined sentiments of this reverend gentleman, from this single stroke in his character, which I think comes up to any of the honest refinements of the peerless knight of La Mancha, whom, by the by, with all his follies, I love more, and would actually have gone farther to have paid a visit to, than the greatest hero of antiquity. But this is not the moral of my story. The thing I had in view was to show the temper of the world in the whole of this affair. For you must know, that so long as this explanation would have done the parson credit, the devil a soul could find it out, I suppose his enemies would not, and that his friends could not. But no sooner did he bestir himself in behalf of the midwife, and pay the expenses of the ordinary's license to set her up, but the whole secret came out, every horse he had lost, and 2 horses more than ever he had lost, with all the circumstances of their destruction, were known and distinctly remembered. The story ran like wildfire. The parson had a returning fit of pride which had just seized him, and he was going to be well mounted once again in his life, and if it was so, 'twas plain as the sun at noonday, he would pocket the expense of the license 10 times told, the very first year, so that everybody was left to judge what were his views in this act of charity. What were his views in this, and in every other action of his life, or rather what were the opinions which floated in the brains of other people concerning it, was a thought which too much floated in his own, and too often broke in upon his rest, when he should have been sound asleep. About 10 years ago this gentleman had the good fortune to be made entirely easy upon that score, it being just so long since he left his parish, and the whole world at the same time behind him, and stands accountable to a judge of whom he will have no cause to complain. But there is a fatality attends the actions of some men, order them as they will, they pass through a certain medium, which so twists and refracts them from their true directions that, with all the titles to praise which a rectitude of heart can give, the doers of them are nevertheless forced to live and die without it. Of the truth of which, this gentleman was a painful example. But to know by what means this came to pass, and to make that knowledge of use to you, I insist upon it that you read the 2 following chapters, which contain such a sketch of his life and conversation, as will carry its moral along with it. When this is done, if nothing stops us in our way, we will go on with the midwife. 1 Chapter 1. 11. Yorick was this parson's name, and, what is very remarkable in it, as appears from a most ancient account of the family, wrote upon strong vellum, and now in perfect preservation, it had been exactly so spelt for near, I was within an ace of saying 900 years, but I would not shake my credit in telling an improbable truth, however indisputable in itself, and therefore I shall content myself with only saying it had been exactly so spelt, without the least variation or transposition of a single letter, for I do not know how long, which is more than I would venture to say of 1/2 of the best surnames in the kingdom, which, in a course of years, have generally undergone as many chops and changes as their owners. Has this been owing to the pride, or to the shame of the respective proprietors? In honest truth, I think sometimes to the one, and sometimes to the other, just as the temptation has wrought. But a villainous affair it is, and will one day so blend and confound us altogether, that no one shall be able to stand up and swear, that his own great-grandfather was the man who did either this or that. This evil had been sufficiently fenced against by the prudent care of the Yorick's family, and the religious preservation of these records I quote, which do farther inform us, that the family was originally of Danish extraction, and had been transplanted into England as early as in the reign of Horwund Illis, King of Denmark, in whose court, it seems, an ancestor of this Mr. Yorick's, and from whom he was lineally descended, held a considerable post to the day of his death. Of what nature this considerable post was, this record saith not, it only adds, that, for near 2 centuries, it had been totally abolished, as altogether unnecessary, not only in that court, but in every other court of the Christian world. It has often come into my head, that this post could be no other than that of the king's chief jester, and that Hamlet's Yorick, in our Shakespeare, many of whose plays, you know, are founded upon authenticated facts, was certainly the very man. I have not the time to look into Saxo Grammaticus's Danish history, to know the certainty of this, but if you have leisure, and can easily get at the book, you may do it full as well yourself. I had just time, in my travels through Denmark with Mr. Noddy's eldest son, whom, in the year 1741, I accompanied as governor, riding along with him at a prodigious rate through most parts of Europe, and of which original journey performed by us too, a most delectable narrative will be given in the progress of this work. I had just time, I say, and that was all, to prove the truth of an observation made by a long sojourner in that country, namely, that nature was neither very lavish, nor was she very stingy in her gifts of genius and capacity to its inhabitants, but, like a discreet parent, was moderately kind to them all, observing such an equal tenor in the distribution of her favors, as to bring them, in those points, pretty near to a level with each other, so that you will meet with few instances in that kingdom of refined parts, but a great deal of good plain household understanding amongst all ranks of people, of which everybody has a share, which is, I think, very right. With us, you see, the case is quite different. We are all ups and downs in this matter. You are a great genius, or 50-1, sir, you are a great dunce and a blockhead, not that there is a total one of intermediate steps, no, we are not so irregular as that comes to, but the two extremes are more common, and in a greater degree in this unsettled island, where nature, in her gifts and dispositions of this kind, is most whimsical and capricious, fortune herself not being more so in the bequest of her goods and chattels than she. This is all that ever staggered my faith in regard to Yorick's extraction, who, by what I can remember of him, and by all the accounts I could ever get of him, seemed not to have had one single drop of Danish blood in his whole crasis. In 900 years, it might possibly have all run out. I will not philosophize one moment with you about it, for happen how it would, the fact was this, that instead of that cold phlegm and exact regularity of sense and humors, you would have looked for, in one so extracted, he was, on the contrary, as mercurial and sublimated a composition, as heteroclite a creature in all his declensions, with as much life and whim, and gaieté de cœur about him, as the kindliest climate could have engendered and put together. With all this sail, poor Yorick carried not 1 ounce of ballast. He was utterly unpracticed in the world, and at the age of 26, knew just about as well how to steer his course in it, as a romping, unsuspicious girl of 13, so that upon his first setting out, the brisk gale of his spirits, as you will imagine, ran him foul 10 times in a day of somebody's tackling, and as the grave and more slow-paced were oftenest in his way, you may likewise imagine, 'twas with such he had generally the ill luck to get the most entangled. For aught I know there might be some mixture of unlucky wit at the bottom of such fracas, for, to speak the truth, Yorick had an invincible dislike and opposition in his nature to gravity, not to gravity as such, for where gravity was wanted, he would be the most grave or serious of mortal men for days and weeks together, but he was an enemy to the affectation of it, and declared open war against it, only as it appeared a cloak for ignorance, or for folly, and then, whenever it fell in his way, however sheltered and protected, he seldom gave it much quarter. Sometimes, in his wild way of talking, he would say, that gravity was an arrant scoundrel, and he would add, of the most dangerous kind too, because a sly one, and that he verily believed, more honest, well-meaning people were bubbled out of their goods and money by it in 1/12 month, than by pocket-picking and shoplifting in 7. In the naked temper which a merry heart discovered, he would say there was no danger, but to itself, whereas the very essence of gravity was design, and consequently deceit, 'twas a taught trick to gain credit of the world for more sense and knowledge than a man was worth, and that, with all its pretensions, it was no better, but often worse, than what a French wit had long ago defined it, viz. A mysterious carriage of the body to cover the defects of the mind semicolon which definition of gravity, Yorick, with great imprudence, would say, deserved to be wrote in letters of gold. But, in plain truth, he was a man unhackneyed and unpracticed in the world, and was altogether as indiscreet and foolish on every other subject of discourse where policy is wont to impress restraint. Yorick had no impression but one, and that was what arose from the nature of the deed spoken of, which impression he would usually translate into plain English without any periphrasis, and too oft without much distinction of either person, time, or place, so that when mention was made of a pitiful or an ungenerous proceeding he never gave himself a moment's time to reflect who was the hero of the piece, what his station, or how far he had power to hurt him hereafter, but if it was a dirty action, without more ado, the man was a dirty fellow, and so on. And as his comments had usually the ill fate to be terminated either in a bon mot, or to be enlivened throughout with some drollery or humor of expression, it gave wings to Yorick's indiscretion. In a word, though he never saw it, yet, at the same time, as he seldom shunned occasions of saying what came uppermost, and without much ceremony, he had but too many temptations in life, of scattering his wit and his humor, his gibes and his jests about him. They were not lost for want of gathering. What were the consequences, and what was Yorick's catastrophe thereupon, you will read in the next chapter. 2 Chapter 1. 12. The mortgager and mortgagee differ the one from the other, not more in length of purse, than the jester and jestee do, in that of memory. But in this the comparison between them runs, as the scholiasts call it, upon all four, which, by the by, is upon one or two legs more than some of the best of Homers can pretend to, namely, that the one raises a sum, and the other a laugh at your expense, and thinks no more about it. Interest, however, still runs on in both cases, the periodical or accidental payments of it, just serving to keep the memory of the affair alive, till, at length, in some evil hour, pop comes the creditor upon each, and by demanding principal upon the spot, together with full interest to the very day, makes them both feel the full extent of their obligations. As the reader, for I hate your ifs, has a thorough knowledge of human nature, I need not say more to satisfy him, that my hero could not go on at this rate without some slight experience of these incidental mementos. To speak the truth, he had wantonly involved himself in a multitude of small book debts of this stamp, which, notwithstanding Eugenius's frequent advice, he too much disregarded, thinking, that as not one of them was contracted through any malignancy, but, on the contrary, from an honesty of mind, and a mere jocundity of humor, they would all of them be crossed out in course. Eugenius would never admit this, and would often tell him, that one day or other he would certainly be reckoned with, and he would often add, in an accent of sorrowful apprehension, to the uttermost might. To which Yorick, with his usual carelessness of heart, would as often answer with a pshaw. And if the subject was started in the fields, with a hop, skip, and a jump at the end of it, but if close pent up in the social chimney corner, where the culprit was barricaded in, with a table and a couple of armchairs, and could not so readily fly off in a tangent, Eugenius would then go on with his lecture upon discretion in words to this purpose, though somewhat better put together. Trust me, dear Yorick, this unwary pleasantry of thine will sooner or later bring thee into scrapes and difficulties, which no after wit can extricate thee out of. In these sallies, too oft, I see, it happens, that a person laughed at, considers himself in the light of a person injured, with all the rights of such a situation belonging to him, and when thou viewest him in that light too, and reckons up his friends, his family, his kindred and allies, and musters up with them the many recruits which will list under him from a sense of common danger, 'tis no extravagant arithmetic to say, that for every 10 jokes, thou hast got 100 enemies, and till thou hast gone on, and raised a swarm of wasps about thine ears, and art half stung to death by them, thou wilt never be convinced it is so. I cannot suspect it in the man whom I esteem, that there is the least spur from spleen or malevolence of intent in these sallies. I believe and know them to be truly honest and sportive, but consider, my dear lad, that fools cannot distinguish this, and that knaves will not, and thou knowest not what it is, either to provoke the one, or to make merry with the other, whenever they associate for mutual defense. Depend upon it, they will carry on the war in such a manner against thee, my dear friend, as to make thee heartily sick of it, and of thy life too. Revenge from some baneful corner shall level a tale of dishonor at thee, which no innocence of heart or integrity of conduct shall set right. The fortunes of thy house shall totter, thy character, which led the way to them, shall bleed on every side of it, thy faith questioned, thy works belied, thy wit forgotten, thy learning trampled on. To wind up the last scene of thy tragedy, cruelty and cowardice, twin ruffians, hired and set on by malice in the dark, shall strike together at all thy infirmities and mistakes. The best of us, my dear lad, lie open there, and trust me, Yorick, when to gratify a private appetite, it is once resolved upon, that an innocent and an helpless creature shall be sacrificed, 'tis an easy matter to pick up sticks enough from any thicket where it has strayed, to make a fire to offer it up with. Yorick scarce ever heard this sad vaticination of his destiny read over to him, but with a tear stealing from his eye, and a promissory look attending it, that he was resolved, for the time to come, to ride his tit with more sobriety. But, alas, too late. A grand confederacy with, and, at the head of it, was formed before the first prediction of it. The whole plan of the attack, just as Eugenius had foreboded, was put in execution all at once, with so little mercy on the side of the allies, and so little suspicion in Yorick, of what was carrying on against him, that when he thought, good easy man, full surely preferment was o'ripening, they had smote his root, and then he fell, as many a worthy man had fallen before him. Yorick, however, fought it out with all imaginable gallantry for some time, till, overpowered by numbers, and worn out at length by the calamities of the war, but more so, by the ungenerous manner in which it was carried on, he threw down the sword, and though he kept up his spirits in appearance to the last, he died, nevertheless, as was generally thought, quite broken-hearted. What inclined Eugenius to the same opinion was as follows. A few hours before Yorick breathed his last, Eugenius stepped in with an intent to take his last sight and last farewell of him. Upon his drawing Yorick's curtain, and asking how he felt himself, Yorick looking up in his face took hold of his hand, and after thanking him for the many tokens of his friendship to him, for which, he said, if it was their fate to meet hereafter, He would thank him again and again, he told him. He was within a few hours of giving his enemies the slip forever. "I hope not," answered Eugenius, with tears trickling down his cheeks, and with the tenderest tone that ever man spoke. "I hope not, Yorick," said he. Yorick replied, with a look up, and a gentle squeeze of Eugenius's hand, and that was all, but it cut Eugenius to his heart. "Come, come, Yorick," quoth Eugenius, wiping his eyes, and summoning up the man within him, "my dear lad, be comforted. Let not all thy spirits and fortitude forsake thee at this crisis when thou most wants them. Who knows what resources are in store, and what the power of God may yet do for thee?" Yorick laid his hand upon his heart, and gently shook his head. "For my part," continued Eugenius, crying bitterly as he uttered the words, "I declare I know not, Yorick, how to part with thee, and would gladly flatter my hopes," added Eugenius, cheering up his voice, "that there is still enough left of thee to make a bishop, and that I may live to see it. I beseech thee, Eugenius," quoth Yorick, taking off his nightcap as well as he could with his left hand, his right being still grasped close in that of Eugenius, "I beseech thee to take a view of my head." "I see nothing that ails it," replied Eugenius. "Then, alas! My friend," said Yorick, "let me tell you, that 'tis so bruised and misshapen with the blows which, and some others have so unhandsomely given me in the dark, that I might say with Sancho Panza, that should I recover, and mitres thereupon be suffered to rain down from heaven as thick as hail, not one of them would fit it." Yorick's last breath was hanging upon his trembling lips ready to depart as he uttered this, yet still it was uttered with something of a servantic tone, and as he spoke it, Eugenius could perceive a stream of lambent fire lighted up for a moment in his eyes, faint picture of those flashes of his spirit, which, as Shakespeare said of his ancestor, were wont to set the table in a roar. Eugenius was convinced from this, that the heart of his friend was broke. He squeezed his hand, and then walked softly out of the room, weeping as he walked. Yorick followed Eugenius with his eyes to the door. He then closed them, and never opened them more. He lies buried in the corner of his churchyard, in the parish of, under a plain marble slab, which his friend Eugenius, by leave of his executors, laid upon his grave, with no more than these three words of inscription, serving both for his epitaph and elegy: "Alas, poor Yorick!" 10 times a day has Yorick's ghost the consolation to hear his monumental inscription read over with such a variety of plaintive tones, as denote a general pity and esteem for him. A footway crossing the churchyard close by the side of his grave, not a passenger goes by without stopping to cast a look upon it, and sighing as he walks on, "Alas, poor Yorick!" 3 Chapter 1. 13. It is so long since the reader of this rhapsodical work has been parted from the midwife, that it is high time to mention her again to him, merely to put him in mind that there is such a body still in the world, and whom, upon the best judgment I can form upon my own plan at present, I am going to introduce to him for good and all. But as fresh matter may be started, and much unexpected business fall out betwixt the reader and myself, which may require immediate dispatch, 'twas right to take care that the poor woman should not be lost in the meantime, because when she is wanted, we can no way do without her. I think I told you that this good woman was a person of no small note and consequence throughout our whole village and township, that her fame had spread itself to the very out edge and circumference of that circle of importance, of which kind every soul living, whether he has a shirt to his back or no, has one surrounding him, which said circle, by the way, whenever 'tis said that such a one is of great weight and importance in the world, I desire may be enlarged or contracted in your worship's fancy, in a compound ratio of the station, profession, knowledge, abilities, height and depth, measuring both ways, of the personage brought before you. In the present case, if I remember, I fixed it about 4 or 5 miles, which not only comprehended the whole parish, but extended itself to 2 or 3 of the adjacent hamlets in the skirts of the next parish, which made a considerable thing of it. I must add, that she was, moreover, very well looked on at one large grange house, and some other odd houses and farms within 2 or 3 miles, as I said, from the smoke of her own chimney. But I must here, once for all, inform you, that all this will be more exactly delineated and explained in a map, now in the hands of the engraver, which, with many other pieces and developments of this work, will be added to the end of the 20th volume. Not to swell the work, I detest the thought of such a thing, but by way of commentary, scholium, illustration, and key to such passages, incidents, or innuendos as shall be thought to be either of private interpretation, or of dark or doubtful meaning, after my life and my opinions shall have been read over, now don't forget the meaning of the word, by all the world, which, betwixt you and me, and in spite of all the gentlemen reviewers in Great Britain, and of all that their worships shall undertake to write or say to the contrary, I am determined shall be the case. I need not tell your worship that all this is spoke in confidence. 4 chapter 1. 14. Upon looking into my mother's marriage settlement, in order to satisfy myself and reader in a point necessary to be cleared up, before we could proceed any farther in this history, I had the good fortune to pop upon the very thing I wanted before I had read a day and a half straight forwards. It might have taken me up a month, which shows plainly, that when a man sits down to write a history, though it be but the history of Jack Hickathrift or Tom Thumb, he knows no more than his heels what lets and confounded hindrances he is to meet with in his way, or what a dance he may be led, by one excursion or another, before all is over. Could a historiographer drive on his history, as a muleteer drives on his mule, straight forward, for instance, from Rome all the way to Loretto, without ever once turning his head aside, either to the right hand or to the left, he might venture to foretell you to an hour when he should get to his journey's end, but the thing is, morally speaking, impossible, for, if he is a man of the least spirit, he will have 50 deviations from a straight line to make with this or that party as he goes along, which he can no ways avoid. He will have views and prospects to himself perpetually soliciting his eye, which he can no more help standing still to look at than he can fly. He will moreover have various accounts to reconcile, anecdotes to pick up, inscriptions to make out, stories to weave in, traditions to sift, personages to call upon, panegyrics to paste up at this door. Pasquin aids at that, all which both the man and his mule are quite exempt from. To sum up all, there are archives at every stage to be looked into, and rolls, records, documents, and endless genealogies, which justice ever and anon calls him back to stay the reading of. In short, there is no end of it. For my own part, I declare I have been at it these 6 weeks, making all the speed I possibly could, and am not yet born. I have just been able, and that's all, to tell you when it happened, but not how, so that you see the thing is yet far from being accomplished. These unforeseen stoppages, which I own I had no conception of when I first set out, but which, I am convinced now, will rather increase than diminish as I advance, have struck out a hint which I am resolved to follow, and that is, not to be in a hurry, but to go on leisurely, writing and publishing 2 volumes of my life every year, which, if I am suffered to go on quietly, and can make a tolerable bargain with my bookseller, I shall continue to do as long as I live. 5 Chapter 1. 15. The article in my mother's marriage settlement, which I told the reader I was at the pains to search for, and which, now that I have found it, I think proper to lay before him, is so much more fully expressed in the deed itself, than ever I can pretend to do it, that it would be barbarity to take it out of the lawyer's hand. It is as follows. And this indenture further witnesseth, that the said Walter Shandy, merchant, in consideration of the said intended marriage to be had, and, by God's blessing, to be well and truly solemnized and consummated between the said Walter Shandy and Elizabeth Molyneux aforesaid, and divers other good and valuable causes and considerations him thereunto specially moving, doth grant, governant, condescend, consent, conclude, bargain, and fully agree to and with John Dixon, and James Turner, Esquires, the above-named trustees, and C. To wit, that in case it should hereafter so fall out, chance, happen, or otherwise come to pass, that the said Walter Shandy, merchant, shall have left off business before the time or times, that the said Elizabeth Molyneux shall, according to the course of nature, or otherwise, have left off bearing and bringing forth children, and that, in consequence of the said Walter Shandy having so left off business, he shall in despite, and against the free will, consent, and good liking of the said Elizabeth Molyneux, make a departure from the city of London, in order to retire to, and dwell upon, his estate at Shandy Hall, in the county of, or at any other country seat, castle, hall, mansion house, messuage or grange house, now purchased, or hereafter to be purchased, or upon any part or parcel thereof, that then, and as often as the said Elizabeth Molyneux shall happen to be enkained with child or children severally and lawfully begot, or to be begotten, upon the body of the said Elizabeth Molyneux, during her said coverture, he the said Walter Shandy shall, at his own proper cost and charges, and out of his own proper monies, upon good and reasonable notice, which is hereby agreed to be within 6 weeks of her the said Elizabeth Molyneux's full reckoning, for time of supposed and computed delivery, pay, or cause to be paid, the sum of £120 of good and lawful money, to John Dixon, and James Turner, Esquires. Or assigns, upon trust and confidence, and for and unto the use and uses, intent, and purpose following, that is to say, that the said sum of £120 shall be paid into the hands of the said Elizabeth Molyneux, or to be otherwise applied by them the said trustees, For the well and truly hiring of one coach, with able and sufficient horses, to carry and convey the body of the said Elizabeth Molyneux, and the child or children which she shall be then and there enkined and pregnant with, unto the city of London, and for the further paying and defraying of all other incidental costs, charges, and expenses whatsoever, in and about, and for, and relating to, her said intended delivery and lying in the said city or suburbs thereof. And that the said Elizabeth Molyneux shall and may, from time to time, and at all such time and times as are here covenanted and agreed upon, peaceably and quietly hire the said coach and horses, and have free ingress, egress, and regress throughout her journey, in and from the said coach, according to the tenor, true intent, and meaning of these presents, without any let, suit, trouble, disturbance, molestation, discharge, hindrance, forfeiture, eviction, vexation, interruption, or encumbrance whatsoever. And that it shall moreover be lawful to and for the said Elizabeth Molyneux, from time to time, and as oft or often as she shall well and truly be advanced in her said pregnancy, to the time heretofore stipulated and agreed upon, to live and reside in such place or places, and in such family or families, and with such relations, friends, and other persons within the said city of London, as she at her own will and pleasure, notwithstanding her present coverture, and as if she was a femme sole and unmarried, shall think fit. And this indenture further witnesseth, that for the more effectually carrying of the said covenant into execution, the said Walter Shandy, merchant, doth hereby grant, bargain, sell, release, and confirm unto the said John Dixon, and James Turner, Esquires, their heirs, executors, and assigns, in their actual possession now being, by virtue of an indenture of bargain and sale for a year to them the said John Dixon, and James Turner, Esquires, by him the said Walter Shandy, merchant, thereof made, which said bargain and sale for a year, bears date the day next before the date of these presents, and by force and virtue of the statute for transferring of uses into possession, all that the manor and lordship of Shandy, in the county of, with all the rights, members, and appurtenances thereof, and all and every the mess wages, houses, buildings, barns, stables, orchards, gardens, backsides, tofts, crofts, garths, cottages, lands, meadows, feedings, pastures, marshes, commons, woods, underwoods, drains, fisheries, waters, and watercourses, together with all rents, reversions, services, annuities, fee farms, knights' fees, views of frank pledge, escheats, reliefs, mines, quarries, goods and chattels of felons and fugitives, felons of themselves, and put in exigent, deodands, free warrens, and all other royalties and seigneuries, rights and jurisdictions, privileges and hereditaments whatsoever. And also the adbozen, donation, presentation, and free disposition of the rectory or parsonage of Shandy aforesaid, and all and every the tenths, tithes, glebe lands. In three words, my mother was to lay in, if she chose it, in London. But in order to put a stop to the practice of any unfair play on the part of my mother, which a marriage article of this nature too manifestly opened a door to, and which indeed had never been thought of at all, but for my uncle Toby Shandy, a clause was added in security of my father, which was this, that in case my mother hereafter should, at any time, put my father to the trouble and expense of a London journey, upon false cries and tokens, that for every such instance, she should forfeit all the right and title which the covenant gave her to the next turn, but to no more, and so on, totis quotis, in as effectual a manner, as if such a covenant betwixt them had not been made. This, by the way, was no more than what was reasonable, and yet, as reasonable as it was, I have ever thought it hard that the whole weight of the article should have fallen entirely, as it did, upon myself. But I was begotten born to misfortunes, for my poor mother, whether it was wind or water or a compound of both, or neither, or whether it was simply the mere swell of imagination and fancy in her, or how far a strong wish and desire to have it so, might mislead her judgment, in short, whether she was deceived or deceiving in this matter, it no way becomes me to decide. The fact was this, that in the latter end of September 1717, which was the year before I was born, my mother having carried my father up to town much against the grain, he peremptorily insisted upon the clause, so that I was doomed, by marriage articles, to have my nose squeezed as flat to my face, as if the destinies had actually spun me without one. How this event came about, and what a train of vexatious disappointments, in one stage or other of my life, have pursued me from the mere loss, or rather compression, of this one single member, shall be laid before the reader all in due time. 6 Chapter 1. 16. My father, as anybody may naturally imagine, came down with my mother into the country, in but a pettish kind of a humor. The first 20 or 25 miles he did nothing in the world but fret and tease himself, and indeed my mother too, about the cursed expense, which he said might every shilling of it have been saved. Then what vexed him more than everything else was, the provoking time of the year, which, as I told you, was towards the end of September, when his wild fruit and greengages especially, in which he was very curious, were just ready for pulling, had he been whistled up to London, upon a tomfool's errand, in any other month of the whole year, he should not have said 3 words about it. For the next 2 whole stages, no subject would go down, but the heavy blow he had sustained from the loss of a son, whom it seems he had fully reckoned upon in his mind, and registered down in his pocketbook, as a second staff for his old age, in case Bobby should fail him. The disappointment of this, he said, was 10 times more to a wise man, than all the money which the journey, and sea, had cost him, put together, wrought the £120, he did not mind at a rush. From Stilton, all the way to Grantham, nothing in the whole affair provoked him so much as the condolences of his friends, and the foolish figure they should both make at church, the first Sunday, of which, in the satirical vehemence of his wit, now sharpened a little by vexation, he would give so many humorous and provoking descriptions, and place his ribbon self in so many tormenting lights and attitudes in the face of the whole congregation, that my mother declared, these 2 stages were so truly tragi-comical, that she did nothing but laugh and cry in a breath, from one end to the other of them all the way. From Grantham, till they had crossed the Trent, my father was out of all kind of patience at the vile trick and imposition which he fancied my mother had put upon him in this affair. Certainly, he would say to himself, over and over again, the woman could not be deceived herself if she could, what weakness! Exclamation mark tormenting word! Which led his imagination a thorny dance, and, before all was over, played the duce and all with him, for sure as ever the word weakness was uttered, and struck full upon his brain so sure it set him upon running divisions upon how many kinds of weaknesses there were, that there was such a thing as weakness of the body, as well as weakness of the mind, and then he would do nothing but syllogize within himself for a stage or two together, how far the cause of all these vexations might, or might not, have arisen out of himself. In short, he had so many little subjects of disquietude springing out of this one affair, all fretting successively in his mind as they rose up in it, that my mother, whatever was her journey up, had but an uneasy journey of it down. In a word, as she complained to my uncle Toby, he would have tired out the patience of any flesh alive. 7 Chapter 1. 17. Though my father travelled homewards, as I told you, in none of the best of moods, pshawing and pishing all the way down, yet he had the complaisance to keep the worst part of the story still to himself, which was the resolution he had taken of doing himself a justice, which my uncle Toby's clause in the marriage settlement empowered him, nor was it till the very night in which I was begot, which was 13 months after, that she had the least intimation of his design, when my father, happening, as you remember, to be a little chagrined and out of temper, took occasion as they lay chatting gravely in bed afterwards, talking over what was to come, to let her know that she must accommodate herself as well as she could to the bargain made between them in their marriage deeds, which was to lie in of her next child in the country, to balance the last year's journey. My father was a gentleman of many virtues, but he had a strong spice of that in his temper, which might, or might not, add to the number. 'Tis known by the name of perseverance in a good cause, and of obstinacy in a bad one. Of this my mother had so much knowledge, that she knew 'twas to no purpose to make any remonstrance, so she e'en resolved to sit down quietly, and make the most of it. 8 Chapter 1. 18. As the point was that night agreed, or rather determined, that my mother should lie in of me in the country, she took her measures accordingly, for which purpose, when she was 3 days, or thereabouts, gone with child, she began to cast her eyes upon the midwife, whom you have so often heard me mention, and before the week was well got round, as the famous Dr. Manningham was not to be had, she had come to a final determination in her mind, notwithstanding there was a scientific operator within so near a call as 8 miles of us, and who, moreover, had expressly wrote a 5 shillings book upon the subject of midwifery, in which he had exposed, not only the blunders of the sisterhood itself, but had likewise superadded many curious improvements for the quicker extraction of the fetus in cross births, and some other cases of danger, which belay us in getting into the world. Notwithstanding all this, my mother, I say, was absolutely determined to trust her life, and mine with it, into no soul's hand but this old woman's only. Now this I like, when we cannot get at the very thing we wish never to take up with the next best in degree to it. No, that's pitiful beyond description. It is no more than a week from this very day, in which I am now writing this book for the edification of the world, which is March 9, 1759, that my dear, dear Jenny, observing I looked a little grave, as she stood cheapening a silk of 25 shillings a yard, told the mercer, she was sorry she had given him so much trouble, and immediately went and bought herself a yard-wide stuff of 10 pence a yard. 'Tis the duplication of one and the same greatness of soul, only what lessened the honor of it, somewhat, in my mother's case, was, that she could not heroine it into so violent and hazardous an extreme, as one in her situation might have wished, because the old midwife had really some little claim to be depended upon, as much, at least, as success could give her, having, in the course of her practice of near 20 years in the parish, brought every mother's son of them into the world without any one slip or accident which could fairly be laid to her account. These facts, though they had their weight, yet did not altogether satisfy some few scruples and uneasinesses which hung upon my father's spirits in relation to this choice. To say nothing of the natural workings of humanity and justice or of the yearnings of parental and connubial love, all which prompted him to leave as little to hazard as possible in a case of this kind, he felt himself concerned in a particular manner, that all should go right in the present case, from the accumulated sorrow he lay open to, should any evil betide his wife and child in lying in at Shandy Hall. He knew the world judged by events, and would add to his afflictions in such a misfortune, by loading him with the whole blame of it. Alas O day, had Mrs. Shandy, poor gentlewoman, had but her wish in going up to town just to lie in and come down again, which they say, she begged and prayed for upon her bare knees, and which, in my opinion, considering the fortune which Mr. Shandy got with her, was no such mighty matter to have complied with, the lady and her babe might both of them have been alive at this hour. This exclamation, my father knew, was unanswerable, and yet, it was not merely to shelter himself, nor was it altogether for the care of his offspring and wife that he seemed so extremely anxious about this point. My father had extensive views of things, and stood moreover, as he thought, deeply concerned in it for the public good, from the dread he entertained of the ban uses an ill-fated instance might be put to. He was very sensible that all political writers upon the subject had unanimously agreed and lamented, from the beginning of Queen Elizabeth's reign down to his own time, that the current of men and money towards the metropolis, upon one frivolous errand or another, set in so strong, as to become dangerous to our civil rights, though, by the by, a current was not the image he took most delight in. A distemper was here his favorite metaphor, and he would run it down into a perfect allegory, by maintaining it was identically the same in the body national as in the body natural, where the blood and spirits were driven up into the head faster than they could find their ways down. A stoppage of circulation must ensue, which was death in both cases. There was little danger, he would say, of losing our liberties by French politics or French invasions, nor was he so much in pain of a consumption from the mass of corrupted matter and ulcerated humors in our constitution, which he hoped was not so bad as it was imagined, but he verily feared, that in some violent push, we should go off, all at once, in a state apoplexy, and then he would say, the Lord have mercy upon us all. My father was never able to give the history of this distemper, without the remedy along with it. Was I an absolute prince, he would say, pulling up his breeches with both his hands, as he rose from his armchair, I would appoint able judges, at every avenue of my metropolis, who should take cognizance of every fool's business who came there, and if, upon a fair and candid hearing, it appeared not of weight sufficient to leave his own home, and come up, bag and baggage, with his wife and children, farmers' sons, and see. At his backside, they should be all sent back, from constable to constable, like vagrants as they were, to the place of their legal settlements. By this means I shall take care, that my metropolis tottered not through its own weight, that the head be no longer too big for the body, that the extremes, now wasted and pinned in, be restored to their due share of nourishment, and regain with it their natural strength and beauty. I would effectually provide, that the meadows and cornfields of my dominions, should laugh and sing, that good cheer and hospitality flourish once more, and that such weight and influence be put thereby into the hands of the squirality of my kingdom, as should counterpoise what I perceive my nobility are now taking from them. Why are there so few palaces and gentlemen's seats? He would ask, with some emotion, as he walked across the room, throughout so many delicious provinces in France? Whence is it that the few remaining shadows amongst them are so dismantled, so unfurnished, and in so ruinous and desolate a condition? Because, sir, he would say, in that kingdom no man has any country interest to support, the little interest of any kind which any man has anywhere in it, is concentrated in the court, and the looks of the grand monarch, by the sunshine of whose countenance, or the clouds which pass across it, every Frenchman lives or dies. Another political reason which prompted my father so strongly to guard against the least evil accident in my mother's lying in the country, was that any such instance would infallibly throw a balance of power, too great already, into the weaker vessels of the gentry, in his own, or higher stations, which, with the many other usurped rights which that part of the Constitution was hourly establishing, would, in the end, prove fatal to the monarchical system of domestic government established in the first creation of things by God. In this point he was entirely of Sir Robert Filmer's opinion, that the plans and institutions of the greatest monarchies in the eastern parts of the world, were, originally, all stolen from that admirable pattern and prototype of this household and paternal power, which, for a century, he said, and more, had gradually been degenerating away into a mixed government, the form of which, however desirable in great combinations of the species, was very troublesome in small ones, and seldom produced anything, that he saw, but sorrow and confusion. For all these reasons, private and public, put together, my father was for having the man midwife by all means, my mother, by no means. My father begged and entreated, she would for once recede from her prerogative in this matter, and suffer him to choose for her. My mother, on the contrary, insisted upon her privilege in this matter, to choose for herself, and have no mortal's help but the old woman's. What could my father do? He was almost at his wit's end, talked it over with her in all moods, placed his arguments in all lights, argued the matter with her like a Christian, like a heathen, like a husband, like a father, like a patriot, like a man. My mother answered everything only like a woman, which was a little hard upon her, for as she could not assume and fight it out behind such a variety of characters, 'twas no fair match, 'twas 7-1. What could my mother do? She had the advantage, otherwise she had been certainly overpowered, of a small reinforcement of chagrin personal at the bottom, which bore her up, and enabled her to dispute the affair with my father with so equal an advantage, that both sides sung Te Deum. In a word, my mother was to have the old woman, and the operator was to have licensed to drink a bottle of wine with my father and my uncle Toby Shandy in the back parlour, for which he was to be paid 5 guineas. I must beg leave, before I finish this chapter, to enter a caveat in the breast of my fair reader, and it is this, not to take it absolutely for granted, from an unguarded word or two which I have dropped in it, that I am a married man. I own the tender appellation of my dear, dear Jenny, with some other strokes of conjugal knowledge, interspersed here and there, might, naturally enough, have misled the most candid judge in the world into such a determination against me. All I plead for, in this case, madam, is strict justice, and that you do so much of it, to me as well as to yourself, as not to prejudge, or receive such an impression of me, till you have better evidence, than, I am positive, at present can be produced against me. Not that I can be so vain or unreasonable, madam, as to desire you should therefore think, that my dear, dear Jenny is my kept mistress. No, that would be flattering my character in the other extreme, and giving it an air of freedom, which, perhaps, it has no kind of right to. All I contend for, is the utter impossibility, for some volumes, that you, or the most penetrating spirit upon earth, should know how this matter really stands. It is not impossible, but that my dear, dear Jenny, tender as the appellation is, may be my child. Consider, I was born in the year 18. Nor is there anything unnatural or extravagant in the supposition, that my dear Jenny may be my friend. Friend. My friend. Surely, madam, a friendship between the two sexes may subsist, and be supported without fie. Mr. Shandy, without anything, madam, but that tender and delicious sentiment which ever mixes in friendship, where there is a difference of sex. Let me entreat you to study the pure and sentimental parts of the best French romances. It will really, madam, astonish you to see with what a variety of chaste expressions this delicious sentiment, which I have the honor to speak of, is dressed out. 9 Chapter 1. 19. I would sooner undertake to explain the hardest problem in geometry, than pretend to account for it, that a gentleman of my father's great good sense, knowing, as the reader must have observed him, and curious too in philosophy, wise also in political reasoning, and in polemical, as he will find, no way ignorant, could be capable of entertaining a notion in his head, so out of the common track, that I fear the reader, when I come to mention it to him, if he is the least of a choleric temper, will immediately throw the book by, if mercurial, he will laugh most heartily at it, and if he is of a grave and saturnine cast, he will, at first sight, absolutely condemn as fanciful and extravagant, and that was in respect to the choice and imposition of Christian names, on which he thought a great deal more depended than what superficial minds were capable of conceiving. His opinion, in this matter, was, that there was a strange kind of magic bias, which good or bad names, as he called them, irresistibly impressed upon our characters and conduct. The hero of Cervantes argued not the point with more seriousness, nor had he more faith, or more to say on the powers of necromancy in dishonoring his deeds, or on Elsinea's name, in shedding luster upon them, than my father had on those of Trismegistus or Archimedes, on the one hand, or of Nike and Simcaon on the other. How many Caesars and Pompeys, he would say, by mere inspiration of the names, have been rendered worthy of them? And how many, he would add, are there, who might have done exceeding well in the world, had not their characters and spirits been totally depressed and Nicodemus'd into nothing? I see plainly, sir, by your looks, or as the case happened, my father would say that you do not heartily subscribe to this opinion of mine, which, to those, he would add, who have not carefully sifted it to the bottom, I own has an air more of fancy than of solid reasoning in it. And yet, my dear sir, if I may presume to know your character, I am morally assured, I should hazard little in stating a case to you, not as a party in the dispute, but as a judge, and trusting my appeal upon it to your own good sense and candid disquisition in this matter. You are a person free from as many narrow prejudices of education as most men, and, if I may presume to penetrate farther into you, of a liberality of genius above bearing down an opinion, merely because it wants friends. Your son, your dear son, from whose sweet and open temper you have so much to expect. Your Billy, sir. Would you, for the world, have called him Judas? Would you, my dear sir, he would say, laying his hand upon your breast, with the genteelest address, and in that soft and irresistible piano of voice, which the nature of the argumentum ad hominem absolutely requires, would you, sir, if a Jew of a godfather had proposed the name for your child, and offered you his purse along with it, would you have consented to such a desecration of him? Oh my God! He would say, looking up, if I know your temper right, sir, you are incapable of it, you would have trampled upon the offer, you would have thrown the temptation at the tempter's head with abhorrence. Your greatness of mind in this action, which I admire, with that generous contempt of money, which you show me in the whole transaction, is really noble, and what renders it more so, is the principle of it, the workings of a parent's love upon the truth and conviction of this very hypothesis, namely, that was your son called Judas, the forbidden treacherous idea, so inseparable from the name, would have accompanied him through life like his shadow, and, in the end, made a miser and a rascal of him, in spite, sir, of your example. I never knew a man able to answer this argument. But, indeed, to speak of my father as he was certainly irresistible, both in his orations and disputations. He was born an orator, Greek. Persuasion hung upon his lips, and the elements of logic and rhetoric were so blended up in him, and, withal, he had so shrewd a guess at the weaknesses and passions of his respondent, that nature might have stood up and said, this man is eloquent. In short, whether he was on the weak or the strong side of the question, 'twas hazardous in either case to attack him. And yet, 'tis strange, he had never read Cicero, nor Quintilian or Tor, nor Isocrates, nor Aristotle, nor Longinus, amongst the Antians, nor Vossius, nor Scipius, nor Remus, nor Farnaby, amongst the moderns, and what is more astonishing, he had never in his whole life the least light or spark of subtlety struck into his mind, by one single lecture upon Krakenthorpe or Burgerstitius or any Dutch logician or commentator. He knew not so much as in what the difference of an argument ad ignorantium, and an argument ad hominem consisted, so that I well remember, when he went up along with me to enter my name at Jesus College in, it was a matter of just wonder with my worthy tutor, and two or three fellows of that learned society, that a man who knew not so much as the names of his tools, should be able to work after that fashion with them. To work with them in the best manner he could, was what my father was, however, perpetually forced upon, for he had a thousand little skeptical notions of the comic kind to defend, most of which notions, I verily believe, at first entered upon the footing of mere whims, and of a vive la bagatelle, and as such he would make merry with them for half an hour or so, and having sharpened his wit upon them, dismiss them till another day. I mention this, not only as matter of hypothesis or conjecture upon the progress and establishment of my father's many odd opinions, but as a warning to the learned reader against the indiscreet reception of such guests, who, after a free and undisturbed entrance, for some years, into our brains, at length claim a kind of settlement there, working sometimes like yeast, but more generally after the manner of the gentle passion, beginning in jest, but ending in downright earnest. Whether this was the case of the singularity of my father's notions or that his judgment, at length, became the dupe of his wit, or how far, in many of his notions, he might, though odd, be absolutely right, the reader, as he comes at them, shall decide. All that I maintain here, is, that in this one, of the influence of Christian names, however it gained footing, he was serious, He was all uniformity, he was systematical, and, like all systematic reasoners, he would move both heaven and earth, and twist and torture everything in nature to support his hypothesis. In a word, I repeat it over again, he was serious, and, in consequence of it, he would lose all kind of patience whenever he saw people, especially of condition, who should have known better, as careless and as indifferent about the name they imposed upon their child, or more so, than in the choice of Ponto or Cupid for their puppy dog. This, he would say, looked ill, and had, moreover, this particular aggravation in it, viz. That when once a vile name was wrongfully or injudiciously given, 'twas not like the case of a man's character, which, when wronged, might hereafter be cleared, and, possibly, some time or other, if not in the man's life, at least after his death, be, somehow or other, set to rights with the world, but the injury of this, he would say, could never be undone. Nay, he doubted even whether an act of Parliament could reach it. He knew as well as you, that the legislature assumed a power over surnames, but for very strong reasons, which he could give, it had never yet adventured, he would say, to go a step farther. It was observable, that though my father, in consequence of this opinion, had, as I have told you, the strongest likings and dislikings towards certain names, that there were still numbers of names which hung so equally in the balance before him, that they were absolutely indifferent to him. Jack, Dick, and Tom were of this class. These my father called neutral names, affirming of them, without a satire, that there had been as many knaves and fools, at least, as wise and good men, since the world began, who had indifferently borne them, so that, like equal forces acting against each other in contrary directions, he thought they mutually destroyed each other's effects, for which reason, he would often declare, he would not give a cherry stone to choose amongst them. Bob, which was my brother's name, was another of these neutral kinds of Christian names, which operated very little either way, and as my father happened to be at Epsom, when it was given him, he would oft-times thank heaven it was no worse. Andrew was something like a negative quantity in algebra with him, 'twas worse, he said, than nothing. William stood pretty high, Numps again was low with him, and Nick, he said, was the devil. But of all names in the universe he had the most unconquerable aversion for Tristram. He had the lowest and most contemptible opinion of it of anything in the world, thinking it could possibly produce nothing in rerum natura, but what was extremely mean and pitiful, so that in the midst of a dispute on the subject, in which, by the by, he was frequently involved, he would sometimes break off in a sudden and spirited epiphonema, or rather erotesis, raised a third, and sometimes a full fifth above the key of the discourse, and demand it categorically of his antagonist, whether he would take upon him to say, he had ever remembered, whether he had ever read, or even whether he had ever heard tell of a man, called Tristram, performing anything great or worth recording. No, he would say, Tristram. The thing is impossible. What could be wanting in my father but to have wrote a book to publish this notion of his to the world? Little boots it to the subtle speculatist to stand single in his opinions, unless he gives them proper vent. It was the identical thing which my father did, for in the year 16, which was 2 years before I was born, he was at the pains of writing an express dissertation simply upon the word Tristram, showing the world, with great candor and modesty, the grounds of his great abhorrence to the name. When this story is compared with the title page, will not the gentle reader pity my father from his soul? To see an orderly and well-disposed gentleman, who though singular, yet inoffensive in his notions, so played upon in them by cross purposes, to look down upon the stage, and see him baffled and overthrown in all his little systems and wishes, to behold a train of events perpetually falling out against him, and in so critical and cruel a way, as if they had purposely been planned and pointed against him, merely to insult his speculations. In a word, to behold such a one, in his old age, ill-fitted for troubles, 10 times in a day suffering sorrow, 10 times in a day calling the child of his prayers Tristram. Melancholy disyllable of sound. Which, to his ears, was unison to nincompoop, and every name vituperative under heaven. By his ashes. I swear it, if ever malignant spirit took pleasure, or busied itself in traversing the purposes of mortal man, it must have been here, and if it was not necessary I should be born before I was christened, I would this moment give the reader an account of it. Zero Chapter 1. 20. How could you, madam, be so inattentive in reading the last chapter? I told you in it, that my mother was not a papist. Papist. You told me no such thing, sir. Madam, I beg leave to repeat it over again, that I told you as plain, at least, as words, by direct inference, could tell you such a thing. Then, sir, I must have missed a page? No, madam, you have not missed a word. Then I was asleep, sir. My pride, madam, cannot allow you that refuge. Then, I declare, I know nothing at all about the matter. That, madam, is the very fault I lay to your charge, and as a punishment for it, I do insist upon it, that you immediately turn back, that is as soon as you get to the next full stop, and read the whole chapter over again. I have imposed this penance upon the lady, neither out of wantonness nor cruelty, but from the best of motives, and therefore shall make her no apology for it when she returns back. 'Tis to rebuke a vicious taste, which has crept into thousands besides herself, of reading straightforwards, more in quest of the adventures, than of the deep erudition and knowledge which a book of this cast, if read over as it should be, would infallibly impart with them the mind should be accustomed to make wise reflections, and draw curious conclusions as it goes along, the habitude of which made Pliny the Younger affirm, that he never read a book so bad, but he drew some profit from it. The stories of Greece and Rome, run over without this turn and application, do less service, I affirm it, than the history of Parismus and Parismenus, or of the seven champions of England, read with it. But here comes my fair lady. Have you read over again the chapter, madam, as I desired you? You have, and did you not observe the passage, upon the second reading, which admits the inference? Not a word like it. Then, madam, be pleased to ponder well the last line but one of the chapter, where I take upon me to say, it was necessary I should be born before I was christened. Had my mother, madam, been a papist, that consequence did not follow. The Romish rituals direct the baptizing of the child, in cases of danger, before it is born, but upon this proviso, that some part or other of the child's body be seen by the baptizer. But the doctors of the Sorbonne, by deliberation held amongst them, April 10, 1733, have enlarged the powers of the midwives, by determining, that though no part of the child's body should appear, that baptism shall, nevertheless, be administered to it by injection, par la moyen d'une petite canule, anglais a squirt. 'Tis very strange that St. Thomas Aquinas, who had so good a mechanical head, both for tying and untying the knots of school divinity, should, after so much pains bestowed upon this, give up the point at last, as a second law shows impossible, infantis and maternus uterus existence, quoth St. Thomas, baptize ari posunt nullo modo dato Thomas. Thomas. If the reader has the curiosity to see the question upon baptism by injection, as presented to the doctors of the Sorbonne, with their consultation thereupon, it is as follows. It is a terrible misfortune for this same book of mine, but more so to the Republic of Letters, so that my own is quite swallowed up in the consideration of it, that this selfsame vile pruriency for fresh adventures in all things, has got so strongly into our habit and humor, and so wholly intent are we upon satisfying the impatience of our concupiscence that way, that nothing but the gross and more carnal parts of a composition will go down, the subtle hints and sly communications of science fly off, like spirits upwards, the heavy moral escapes downwards, and both the one and the other are as much lost to the world, as if they were still left in the bottom of the inkhorn. I wish the male reader has not passed by many a one, as quaint and curious as this one, in which the female reader has been detected. I wish it may have its effects, and that all good people, both male and female, from example, may be taught to think as well as read. Memoir présenté à Messieurs les Docteurs de Sorbonne. Vidi Deventer. Paris Edit. 42, 1734, p. 366. Uncherge Yen Accoucher, représent à Messieurs les Docteurs de Sorbonne, qu'il y a des cas, quoique très rares, ou une mire ni scoroit à cacher, en même l'enfant est tellement renferme dans les ailes de sa mère, qu'il n'y fait paraître aucune partie de son corps. C'est qui seroit un cas, suivant les rituels, de Louis Conferrer, du mois sous condition, le baptême. Le chirurgien, qui consulte, pretend, par le moyen d'une petite canule, de pouvoir baptiser immédiatement l'enfant, sans faire aucun tort à la mère. Il demande si ce moyen, qu'il vient de proposer, est permis en légitime, en s'il peut s'en servir dans les cas qu'il vient d'exposer. Réponse. Le conseil estime, que la question proposée souffre de grandes difficultés. Les théologiens posent donc au pour principe, que le baptême, qui est une naissance spirituelle, suppose une première naissance, il faut être né dans le monde, pour renaître en Jésus Christ, comme ils l'enseignent. S. Thomas, 3 part. Quist. 88 Artic. 2. Sout cette doctrine comme une vérité constante, la ni put, dit C.S. Doctor. Baptiser les enfants qui sont renfermés dans les ailes de leur mère, and est Thomas est font sur ce, que le infans ni son pointness, and ni pouvetra consparmi le otra homme, do il conclude, qu'il ni pouvetra l'objet d'une action extérieure, pour recevoir par leur ministère, les sacrements nécessaires au salut, puer in maternus uterus existence non d'imprudirunt in lucem ut comalis hominibus vitam ducant, und in non possent subjusi actioni humanae, ut puriorum ministerium sacramenta recipient ad salutum. Les rituels ordonnant dans la pratique c'est que les théologiens ont établi sur les mêmes matières, and ils defendent tout d'une manière uniforme, de baptiser les enfants qui sont renfermés dans les seins de leur mères, s'ils ni sont parents ou quelque partie de leur corps. Le concours des théologiens, and des rituels, qui sont les règles des dioceses, parent former in the autorite qui termine la question présente, cependant le conseil de conscience considérant dans code, que le raisonnement des théologiens est uniquement fondé sur une raison de convenance, and que la défense des rituels suppose que l'on ne peut baptiser immédiatement les enfants en si renfermés dans les seins de leur mères, c'est qui est contre la supposition présente, and dans notre code, considérant que les mêmes théologiens enseignent, que l'on peut risquer les sacrements que Jésus Christ a établis comme des moyens faciles, mais nécessaires pour sanctifier les hommes, and d'ailleurs estimate, que les enfants renfermés dans les seins de leur mères, pourraient être capables de salut, parce qu'ils sont capables de damnation, pour ces considérations, and en égard à l'expose, suivant lequel on assure avoir trouvé un moyen certain de baptiser ses enfants en si renfermés, sans faire aucun tort à la mère, le conseil estime que l'on pourrait se servir du moyen propose, dans la confiance qu'il est, que du na point les ses sorties d'enfants sans aucun secours, and supposant, comme il est expose, que le moyen dont il s'agit est propre leur procurer le baptême, cependant comme il s'agit, en autorisant la pratique proposée, de changer une règle universelle meditable, le conseil croit que celui qui consulte doit s'adresser à son évêque, and a qui il appréciant de juger de l'utilite, and du danger du moyen propose, and comme, sous le bon plaisir de l'évêque, le conseil estime qu'il faudrait recourir au pape, qu'il a droit d'expliquer les règles de l'église, and droit de roger dans la casse, ou la loi ni scorot obliger, quelque sage and quelque utile que paris la manière de baptiser dont il s'agit, le conseil ni pourrait l'approuver sans le concordes du autorites. En conseil au moins celui qui consulte, de s'adresser à son évêque, and de lui faire part de la présente decision, afin que, si le prélat entre dans les raisons sur lesquelles les dictures sous sein s'appuient, il puisse être autorisé dans la caste nécessité, ou il risquerait trop d'attendre que la permission fût demandée et accordée d'employer le moyen qu'il propose si avantageux au salut de l'enfant. Au reste, le conseil, en estimant que l'on pourrait s'en servir, croit cependant, que si les enfants dont il s'agit, venaient au monde, contre l'espérance de ceux qui se seraient service du moyen, il serait nécessaire de les baptiser sous condition, and en cela le conseil se conforme à tous les rituels, qui en autorisant le baptême d'un enfant qui fait parent ou quelque partie de son corps, enjoignant niant moins, and ordonnant de le baptiser sous condition, s'il vient heureusement au monde. Délibérant sur bon, le 10 avril, 1733. A. Lemoyne. L. De Romani. De Marsili. Mr. Tristram Shandy's compliments to Messrs. Lemoyne, De Romani, and De Marsili, hopes they all rested well the night after so tiresome a consultation. He begs to know, whether after the ceremony of marriage, and before that of consummation, the baptizing all the homunculi at once, slapdash, by injection, would not be a shorter and safer cut still, on condition, as above, that if the homunculi do well, and come safe into the world after this, that each and every of them shall be baptized again, sous condition, and provided, in the second place, that the thing can be done, which Mr. Shandy apprehends it may, par le moyen d'une petite canole, and sans faire aucun tort au pire. 1 Chapter 1. 21. I wonder what's all that noise, and running backwards and forwards for, above stairs, quoth my father, addressing himself, after an hour and a half silence, to my uncle Toby, who, you must know, was sitting on the opposite side of the fire, smoking his social pipe all the time, in mute contemplation of a new pair of black plush breeches which he had got on. What can they be doing, brother? Quoth my father, we can scarce hear ourselves talk. I think, replied my uncle Toby, taking his pipe from his mouth, and striking the head of it two or three times upon the nail of his left thumb, as he began his sentence, I think, says he, but to enter rightly into my uncle Toby's sentiments upon this matter, You must be made to enter first a little into his character, the outlines of which I shall just give you, and then the dialogue between him and my father will go on as well again. Pray, what was that man's name? For I write in such a hurry, I have no time to recollect or look for it. Who first made the observation that there was great inconstancy in our air and climate? Whoever he was, 'twas a just and good observation in him. But the corollary drawn from it, namely, that it is this which has furnished us with such a variety of odd and whimsical characters, semicolon, that was not his, it was found out by another man, at least a century and a half after him, then again, that this copious storehouse of original materials, is the true and natural cause that our comedies are so much better than those of France, or any others that either have, or can be wrote upon the continent. That discovery was not fully made till about the middle of King William's reign, when the great Dryden, in writing one of his long prefaces, if I mistake not, most fortunately hit upon it. Indeed, toward the latter end of Queen Anne, the great Addison began to patronize the notion, and more fully explained it to the world in one or two of his Spectators, but the discovery was not his. Then, fourthly and lastly, that this strange irregularity in our climate, producing so strange an irregularity in our characters, doth thereby, in some sort, make us amends, by giving us somewhat to make us merry with when the weather will not suffer us to go out of doors. That observation is my own, and was struck out by me this very rainy day, March 26, 1759, and betwixt the hours of 9 and 10 in the morning. Thus, my fellow laborers and associates in this great harvest of our learning, now ripening before our eyes, thus it is, by slow steps of casual increase, that our knowledge physical, metaphysical, physiological, polemical, nautical, mathematical, enigmatical, technical, biographical, romantical, chemical, and obstetrical, with 50 other branches of it, most of amending as these do, in ICAO, have for these two last centuries and more, gradually been creeping upwards towards that acme of their perfections, from which, if we may form a conjecture from the advances of these last 7 years, we cannot possibly be far off. When that happens, it is to be hoped, it will put an end to all kind of writings whatsoever. The want of all kind of writing will put an end to all kind of reading, and that in time, as war begets poverty, poverty peace, must, in course, put an end to all kind of knowledge, and then we shall have all to begin over again, or, in other words, be exactly where we started. Happy. Thrice happy times. I only wish that the era of my begetting, as well as the mode and manner of it, had been a little altered, or that it could have been put off, with any convenience to my father or mother, for some 20 or 25 years longer, when a man in the literary world might have stood some chance. Dash. But I forget my uncle Toby, whom all this while we have left knocking the ashes out of his tobacco pipe. His humor was of that particular species, which does honor to our atmosphere, and I should have made no scruple of ranking him amongst one of the first-rate productions of it, had not there appeared too many strong lines in it of a family likeness, which showed that he derived the singularity of his temper more from blood, than either wind or water, or any modifications or combinations of them whatever, and I have, therefore, oft times wondered, that my father, though I believe he had his reasons for it, upon his observing some tokens of eccentricity, in my course, when I was a boy, should never once endeavor to account for them in this way, for all the Shandy family were of an original character throughout, I mean the males. The females had no character at all, except, indeed, my great-aunt Dinah, who, about 60 years ago, was married and got with child by the coachman, for which my father, according to his hypothesis of Christian names, would often say, she might thank her godfathers and godmothers. It will seem strange, and I would as soon think of dropping a riddle in the reader's way, which is not my interest to do, as set him upon guessing how it could come to pass, that an event of this kind, so many years after it had happened, should be reserved for the interruption of the peace and unity, which otherwise so cordially subsisted, between my father and my uncle Toby. One would have thought, that the whole force of the misfortune should have spent and wasted itself in the family at first, as is generally the case. But nothing ever wrought with our family after the ordinary way. Possibly at the very time this happened, it might have something else to afflict it, and as afflictions are sent down for our good, and that is this had never done the Shandy family any good at all, it might lie waiting till apt times and circumstances should give it an opportunity to discharge its office. Observe, I determine nothing upon this. My way is ever to point out to the curious, different tracks of investigation, to come at the first springs of the events I tell, not with a pedantic fescue, or in the decisive manner or Tacitus, who outwits himself and his reader, but with the officious humility of a heart devoted to the assistance merely of the inquisitive. To them I write, And by them I shall be read, if any such reading as this could be supposed to hold out so long, to the very end of the world. Why this cause of sorrow, therefore, was thus reserved for my father and uncle, is undetermined by me. But how and in what direction it exerted itself so as to become the cause of dissatisfaction between them, after it began to operate, is what I am able to explain with great exactness, and is as follows. My uncle Toby Shandy, madam, was a gentleman, who, with the virtues which usually constitute the character of a man of honor and rectitude, possessed one in a very eminent degree, which is seldom or never put into the catalogue, and that was a most extreme and unparalleled modesty of nature, though I correct the word nature, for this reason, that I may not prejudge a point which must shortly come to a hearing, and that is, whether this modesty of his was natural or acquired. Whichever way my uncle Toby came by it, 'twas nevertheless modesty in the truest sense of it, and that is, madam, not in regard to words, for he was so unhappy as to have very little choice in them, but to things, and this kind of modesty so possessed him, and it arose to such a height in him, as almost to equal, if such a thing could be, even the modesty of a woman, that female nicety, madam, and inward cleanliness of mind and fancy, in your sex, which makes you so much the awe of ours. You will imagine, madam, that my uncle Toby had contracted all this from this very source, that he had spent a great part of his time in converse with your sex, and that from a thorough knowledge of you, and the force of imitation which such fair examples render irresistible, he had acquired this amiable turn of mind. I wish I could say so, for unless it was with his sister-in-law, my father's wife and my mother, my uncle Toby scarce exchanged three words with the sex in as many years. No, he got it, madam, by a blow. A blow. Yes, madam, it was owing to a blow from a stone, broke off by a ball from the parapet of a horn work at the siege of Namur, which struck full upon my uncle Toby's groin. Which way could that affect it? The story of that, madam, is long and interesting, but it would be running my history all upon heaps to give it you here. 'Tis for an episode hereafter, and every circumstance relating to it, in its proper place, shall be faithfully laid before you. Till then, it is not in my power to give farther light into this matter, or say more than what I have said already, that my uncle Toby was a gentleman of unparalleled modesty, which happening to be somewhat subtilized and rarefied by the constant heat of a little family pride, they both so wrought together within him, that he could never bear to hear the affair of my Aunt Dinah touched upon, but with the greatest emotion. The least hint of it was enough to make the blood fly into his face, but when my father enlarged upon the story in mixed companies, which the illustration of his hypothesis frequently obliged him to do, the unfortunate blight of one of the fairest branches of the family, would set my uncle Toby's honor and modesty a-bleeding, and he would often take my father aside, in the greatest concern imaginable, to expostulate and tell him, he would give him anything in the world, only to let the story rest. My father, I believe, had the truest love and tenderness for my uncle Toby, that ever one brother bore towards another, and would have done anything in nature, which one brother in reason could have deserted of another, to have made my uncle Toby's heart easy in this, or any other point. But this lay out of his power. My father, as I told you, was a philosopher in grain, speculative, systematical, and my Aunt Dinah's affair was a matter of as much consequence to him, as the retrogradation of the planets to Copernicus, the backslidings of Venus in her orbit fortified the Copernican system, called so after his name, and the backslidings of my Aunt Dinah in her orbit, did the same service in establishing my father's system, which, I trust, will forever hereafter be called the Shandian system, after his. In any other family dishonor, my father, I believe, had as nice a sense of shame as any man whatever, and neither he, nor, I dare say, Copernicus, would have divulged the affair in either case, or have taken the least notice of it to the world, but for the obligations they owed, as they thought, to truth. Amicus Plato, my father would say, construing the words to my uncle Toby, as he went along, Amicus Plato, that is, Dinah was my aunt, said magis amica veritas, but truth is my sister. This contrariety of humors betwixt my father and my uncle, was the source of many a fraternal squabble. The one could not bear to hear the tale of family disgrace recorded, and the other would scarce ever let a day pass to an end without some hint at it. For God's sake, my uncle Toby would cry, and for my sake, and for all our sakes, my dear brother Shandy, do let this story of our aunt's and her ashes sleep in peace. How can you have so little feeling and compassion for the character of our family? What is the character of a family to an hypothesis? My father would reply. Nay, if you come to that, what is the life of a family? The life of a family. My uncle Toby would say, throwing himself back in his armchair, and lifting up his hands, his eyes, and one leg, yes, the life, My father would say, maintaining his point. How many thousands of them are there every year that come cast away, in all civilized countries at least, and considered as nothing but common air, in competition of an hypothesis? In my plain sense of things, my Uncle Toby would answer, every such instance is downright murder, let who will commit it. There lies your mistake, my father would reply, for, in foro scienti there is no such thing as murder, 'tis only death, brother. My Uncle Toby would never offer to answer this by any other kind of argument, than that of whistling half a dozen bars of Lillibullero. You must know it was the usual channel through which his passions got vent, when anything shocked or surprised him, but especially when anything, which he deemed very absurd, was offered. As not one of our logical writers, nor any of the commentators upon them, that I remember, have thought proper to give a name to this particular species of argument. I here take the liberty to do it myself, for two reasons. First, that, in order to prevent all confusion and disputes, it may stand as much distinguished forever, from every other species of argument as the argumentum ad verecundiam, ex absurdo, ex fortiori, or any other argument whatsoever, and, secondly, that it may be said by my children's children, when my head is laid to rest, that their learned grandfather's head had been busied to as much purpose once, as other people's, that he had invented a name, and generously thrown it into the treasury of the Ars Logica, for one of the most unanswerable arguments in the whole science. And, if the end of disputation is more to silence than convince, they may add, if they please, to one of the best arguments too. I do, therefore, by these presents, strictly order and command, that it be known and distinguished by the name and title of the Argumentum Fistulatorium, and no other, and that it rank hereafter with the Argumentum Baculinum and the Argumentum Ad Crominum, and forever hereafter be treated of in the same chapter. As for the Argumentum Tripodium, which is never used but by the woman against the man, and the Argumentum Ad Rem, which, contrariwise, is made use of by the man only against the woman, as these two are enough in conscience for one lecture, and, moreover, as the one is the best answer to the other, let them likewise be kept apart, and be treated of in a place by themselves. 2 Chapter 1. 22. The learned Bishop Hall, I mean the famous Dr. Joseph Hall, who was Bishop of Exeter in King James I's reign, tells us in one of Decades, at the end of his Divine Art of Meditation, imprinted at London, in the year 1610, by John Beale, dwelling in Aldersgate Street, that it is an abominable thing for a man to commend himself ; and I really think it is so. And yet, on the other hand, when a thing is executed in a masterly kind of a fashion, which thing is not likely to be found out, I think it is full as abominable, that a man should lose the honor of it, and go out of the world with the conceit of it rotting in his head. This is precisely my situation. For in this long digression which I was accidentally led into, as in all my digressions, one only excepted, there is a master stroke of digressive skill, the merit of which has all along, I fear, been overlooked by my reader, not for want of penetration in him, but because 'tis an excellence seldom looked for, or expected indeed, in a digression, and it is this, that though my digressions are all fair, as you observe, and that I fly off from what I am about, as far, and as often too, as any writer in Great Britain, yet I constantly take care to order affairs so that my main business does not stand still in my absence. I was just going, for example, to have given you the great outlines of my Uncle Toby's most whimsical character, when my Aunt Dinah and the coachman came across us, and led us a vagary some millions of miles into the very heart of the planetary system. Notwithstanding all this, you perceive that the drawing of my Uncle Toby's character went on gently all the time, not the great contours of it, that was impossible, but some familiar strokes and faint designations of it, were here and there touched on, as we went along, so that you are much better acquainted with my Uncle Toby now than you was before. By this contrivance the machinery of my work is of a species by itself, two contrary motions are introduced into it, and reconciled, which were thought to be at variance with each other. In a word, my work is digressive, and it is progressive too, and at the same time. This, sir, is a very different story from that of the Earth's moving round her axis, in her diurnal rotation, with her progress in her elliptic orbit which brings about the year, and constitutes the variety and vicissitude of seasons we enjoy, though I own it suggested the thought, as I believe the greatest of our boasted improvements and discoveries have come from such trifling hints. Digressions, incontestably, are the sunshine, they are the life, the soul of reading. Take them out of this book, for instance, you might as well take the book along with them, one cold eternal winter would reign in every page of it, restore them to the writer, he steps forth like a bridegroom, bids all hail, brings in variety, and forbids the appetite to fail. All the dexterity is in the good cookery and management of them, so as to be not only for the advantage of the reader, but also of the author, whose distress, in this matter, is truly pitiable, for, if he begins a digression, from that moment, I observe, his whole work stands stock still, and if he goes on with his main work, then there is an end of his digression. This is vile work. For which reason, from the beginning of this, you see, I have constructed the main work and the adventitious parts of it with such intersections, and have so complicated and involved the digressive and progressive movements, one wheel within another, that the whole machine, in general, has been kept to going, and, what's more, it shall be kept to going these 40 years, if it pleases the fountain of health to bless me so long with life and good spirits. 3 Chapter 1. 23. I have a strong propensity in me to begin this chapter very nonsensically, and I will not balk my fancy. Accordingly I set off thus. If the fixture of Momus's glass in the human breast, according to the proposed emendation of that arch-critic, had taken place, first, this foolish consequence would certainly have followed, that the very wisest and very gravest of us all, in one coin or other, must have paid window money every day of our lives. And, secondly, that had the said glass been there set up, nothing more would have been wanting, in order to have taken a man's character, but to have taken a chair and gone softly, as you would to a dioptrical beehive, and looked in, viewed the soul stark naked, observed all her motions, her machinations, traced all her maggots from their first engendering to their crawling forth, watched her loose in her frisks, her gambols, her capricios, and after some notice of her more solemn deportment, consequent upon such frisks, and see. Then taken your pen and ink and set down nothing but what you had seen, and could have sworn to, but this is an advantage not to be had by the biographer in this planet, in the planet Mercury, belike, it may be so, if not better still for him, for there the intense heat of the country, which is proved by computators, from its vicinity to the sun, to be more than equal to that of red-hot iron, must, I think, long ago have vitrified the bodies of the inhabitants, as the efficient cause, to suit them for the climate, which is the final cause, so that betwixt them both, all the tenements of their souls, from top to bottom, may be nothing else, for aught the soundest philosophy can show to the contrary, but one fine transparent body of clear glass, baiting the umbilical knot, so that, till the inhabitants grow old and tolerably wrinkled, whereby the rays of light, in passing through them, become so monstrously refracted, or return reflected from their surfaces in such transverse lines to the eye, that a man cannot be seen through, his soul might as well, unless for mere ceremony, or the trifling advantage which the umbilical point gave her, might, upon all other accounts, I say, as well play the fool out of doors as in her own house. But this, as I said above, is not the case of the inhabitants of this earth. Our minds shine not through the body, but are wrapped up here in a dark covering of uncrystallized flesh and blood, so that, if we would come to the specific characters of them, we must go some other way to work. Many, in good truth, are the ways, which human wit has been forced to take, to do this thing with exactness. Some, for instance, draw all their characters with wind instruments. Virgil takes notice of that way in the affair of Dido and Aeneas, but it is as fallacious as the breath of fame, and, moreover, bespeaks an arrow genius. I am not ignorant that the Italians pretend to a mathematical exactness in their designations of one particular sort of character among them, from the forte or piano of a certain wind instrument they use, which they say is infallible. I dare not mention the name of the instrument in this place, 'tis sufficient we have it amongst us, but never think of making a drawing by it, this is enigmatical, and intended to be so, at least ad populum, and therefore, I beg, madam, when you come here, that you read on as fast as you can, and never stop to make any inquiry about it. There are others again, who will draw a man's character from no other helps in the world, but merely from his evacuations, but this often gives a very incorrect outline, unless, indeed, you take a sketch of his repletions too, and by correcting one drawing from the other, compound one good figure out of them both. I should have no objection to this method, but that I think it must smell too strong of the lamp, and be rendered still more operose, by forcing you to have an eye to the rest of his non-naturals. Why the most natural actions of a man's life should be called his non-naturals, is another question. There are others, fourthly, who disdain every one of these expedients, not from any fertility of their own, but from the various ways of doing it, which they have borrowed from the honorable devices which the pantographic brethren, pantograph, an instrument to copy prints and pictures mechanically, and in any proportion, of the brush have shown in taking copies. These, you must know, are your great historians. One of these you will see drawing a full-length character against the light, That's illiberal, dishonest, and hard upon the character of the man who sits. Others, to mend the matter, will make a drawing of you in the camera, that is most unfair of all, because, there you are sure to be represented in some of your most ridiculous attitudes. To avoid all and every one of these errors in giving you my Uncle Toby's character, I am determined to draw it by no mechanical help whatever, nor shall my pencil be guided by any one wind instrument whichever was blown upon, either on this, or on the other side of the Alps, nor will I consider either his repletions or his discharges, or touch upon his non-naturals, but, in a word, I will draw my Uncle Toby's character from his hobby horse. 4 Chapter 1. 24. If I was not morally sure that the reader must be out of all patience for my Uncle Toby's character, I would here previously have convinced him that there is no instrument so fit to draw such a thing with, as that which I have pitched upon. A man and his hobby horse, though I cannot say that they act and react exactly after the same manner in which the soul and body do upon each other, yet doubtless there is a communication between them of some kind, and my opinion rather is, that there is something in it more of the manner of electrified bodies, and that, by means of the heated parts of the rider, which come immediately into contact with the back of the hobby horse, by long journeys and much friction, it so happens, that the body of the rider is at length filled as full of hobby horsical matter as it can hold, so that if you are able to give but a clear description of the nature of the one, you may form a pretty exact notion of the genius and character of the other. Now the hobby horse which my Uncle Toby always rode upon, was in my opinion an hobby horse well worth giving a description of, if it was only upon the score of his great singularity, for you might have travelled from York to Dover, from Dover to Penzance in Cornwall, and from Penzance to York back again, and not have seen such another upon the road, or if you had seen such a one, whatever haste you had been in, you must infallibly have stopped to have taken a view of him. Indeed, the gait and figure of him was so strange, and so utterly unlike was he, from his head to his tail, to any one of the whole species, that it was now and then made a matter of dispute, whether he was really a hobby horse or number, but as the philosopher would use no other argument to the skeptic, who disputed with him against the reality of motion, save that of rising up upon his legs, and walking across the room, so would my Uncle Toby use no other argument to prove his hobby horse was a hobby horse indeed, but by getting upon his back and riding him about, leaving the world, after that, to determine the point as it thought fit. In good truth, my Uncle Toby mounted him with so much pleasure, and he carried my Uncle Toby so well, that he troubled his head very little with what the world either said or thought about it. It is now high time, however, that I give you a description of him, but to go on regularly, I only beg you will give me leave to acquaint you first, how my Uncle Toby came by him. 5 Chapter 1. 25. The wound in my Uncle Toby's groin, which he received at the siege of Namur, rendering him unfit for the service, it was thought expedient he should return to England, in order, if possible, to be set to rights. He was 4 years totally confined, part of it to his bed, and all of it to his room, and in the course of his cure, which was all that time in hand, suffered unspeakable miseries, owing to a succession of exfoliations from the os pubis, and the outward edge of that part of the coccyx called the os ilium, both which bones were dismally crushed, as much by the irregularity of the stone, which I told you was broke off the parapet, as by its size, though it was pretty large, which inclined the surgeon all along to think that the great injury which it had done my Uncle Toby's groin, was more owing to the gravity of the stone itself, than to the projectile force of it, which he would often tell him was a great happiness. My father at that time was just beginning business in London, and had taken a house, and as the truest friendship and cordiality subsisted between the two brothers, and that my father thought my Uncle Toby could nowhere be so well nursed and taken care of as in his own house, he assigned him the very best apartment in it. And what was a much more sincere mark of his affection still, he would never suffer a friend or an acquaintance to step into the house on any occasion, but he would take him by the hand, and lead him upstairs to see his brother Toby, and chat an hour by his bedside. The history of a soldier's wound beguiles the pain of it, my uncle's visitors at least thought so, and in their daily calls upon him, from the courtesy arising out of that belief, they would frequently turn the discourse to that subject, and from that subject the discourse would generally roll on to the siege itself. These conversations were infinitely kind, and my Uncle Toby received great relief from them, and would have received much more, but that they brought him into some unforeseen perplexities, which, for 3 months together, retarded his cure greatly, and if he had not hit upon an expedient to extricate himself out of them, I verily believe they would have laid him in his grave. What these perplexities of my Uncle Toby were, 'tis impossible for you to guess. If you could, I should blush, not as a relation, not as a man, nor even as a woman, but I should blush as an author, Inasmuch as I set no small store by myself upon this very account, that my reader has never yet been able to guess at anything. And in this, sir, I am of so nice and singular a humor, that if I thought you was able to form the least judgment or probable conjecture to yourself, of what was to come in the next page, I would tear it out of my book. 6 Chapter 1. 26. I have begun a new book, on purpose that I might have room enough to explain the nature of the perplexities in which my uncle Toby was involved, from the many discourses and interrogations about the siege of Namur, where he received his wound. I must remind the reader, in case he has read the history of King William's wars, but if he has not, I then inform him, that one of the most memorable attacks in that siege, was that which was made by the English and Dutch upon the point of the advanced counter-scarp, between the gate of St. Nicholas, which enclosed the great sluice or water stop, where the English were terribly exposed to the shot of the counter-guard and demi-bastion of St. Roch, the issue of which hot dispute, in three words, was this, that the Dutch lodged themselves upon the counter-guard, and that the English made themselves masters of the covered way before St. Nicholas Gate, notwithstanding the gallantry of the French officers, who exposed themselves upon the glassy sword in hand. As this was the principal attack of which my uncle Toby was an eyewitness at Namur, the army of the besiegers being cut off, by the confluence of the Meuse and Sambre, from seeing much of each other's operations, my uncle Toby was generally more eloquent and particular in his account of it, and the many perplexities he was in, arose out of the almost insurmountable difficulties he found in telling his story intelligibly, and giving such clear ideas of the differences and distinctions between the scarp and counter-scarp, the glassy and covered way, the half-moon and ravelin, as to make his company fully comprehend where and what he was about. Writers themselves are too apt to confound these terms, so that you will the less wonder, if in his endeavors to explain them, and in opposition to many misconceptions, that my uncle Toby did oft-times puzzle his visitors, and sometimes himself too. To speak the truth, unless the company my father led upstairs were tolerably clear-headed, or my uncle Toby was in one of his explanatory moods, 'twas a difficult thing, do what he could, to keep the discourse free from obscurity. What rendered the account of this affair the more intricate to my uncle Toby, was this, that in the attack of the counter-scarp, before the gate of St. Nicholas, extending itself from the bank of the Meuse, quite up to the great water-stop, the ground was cut and cross-cut with such a multitude of dikes, drains, rivulets, and sluices, on all sides, and he would get so sadly bewildered, and set fast amongst them, that frequently he could neither get backwards or forwards to save his life, and was oft-times obliged to give up the attack upon that very account only. These perplexing rebuffs gave my uncle Toby Shandy more perturbations than you would imagine, and as my father's kindness to him was continually dragging up fresh friends and fresh inquirers, he had but a very uneasy task of it. No doubt my uncle Toby had great command of himself, and could guard appearances, I believe, as well as most men, yet anyone may imagine, that when he could not retreat out of the ravelin without getting into the half moon, or get out of the covered way without falling down the counter-scarp, nor cross the dike without danger of slipping into the ditch, but that he must have fretted and fumed inwardly, he did so, and the little and hourly vexations, which may seem trifling and of no account to the man who has not read Hippocrates, yet, whoever has read Hippocrates, poor Dr. James Mackenzie, and has considered well the effects which the passions and affections of the mind have upon the digestion, why not of a wound as well as of a dinner, may easily conceive what sharp paroxysms and exacerbations of his wound my uncle Toby must have undergone upon that score only. My uncle Toby could not philosophize upon it, 'twas enough he felt it was so, and having sustained the pain and sorrows of it for 3 months together, he was resolved some way or other to extricate himself. He was one morning lying upon his back in his bed, the anguish and nature of the wound upon his groin suffering him to lie in no other position, when a thought came into his head, that if he could purchase such a thing, and have it pasted down upon a board, as a large map of the fortification of the town and citadel of Namur, with its environs, it might be a means of giving him ease. I take notice of his desire to have the environs along with the town and citadel, for this reason, because my uncle Toby's wound was got in one of the traverses, about 30 tisses from the returning angle of the trench, opposite to the salient angle of the demi-bastion of St. Roch, so that he was pretty confident he could stick a pin upon the identical spot of ground where he was standing on when the stone struck him. All this succeeded to his wishes, and not only freed him from a world of sad explanations, but, in the end, it proved a happy means, as you will read, of procuring my uncle Toby his hobby horse. 7 Chapter 1. 27. There is nothing so foolish, when you are at the expense of making an entertainment of this kind, as to order things so badly, as to let your critics and gentry of refined taste run it down, nor is there anything so likely to make them do it, as that of leaving them out of the party, or, what is full as offensive, of bestowing your attention upon the rest of your guests in so particular a way, as if there was no such thing as a critic, by occupation, at table. I guard against both, for, in the first place, I have left half a dozen places purposely open for them, and in the next place, I pay them all court. Gentlemen, I kiss your hands, I protest no company could give me half the pleasure, by my soul I am glad to see you, I beg only you will make no strangers of yourselves, but sit down without any ceremony, and fall on heartily. I said I had left six places, and I was upon the point of carrying my complaisance so far, as to have left a seventh open for them, and in this very spot I stand on, but being told by a critic, though not by occupation, but by nature, that I had acquitted myself well enough, I shall fill it up directly, hoping, in the meantime, that I shall be able to make a great deal of more room next year. How, in the name of wonder, could your Uncle Toby, who, it seems, was a military man, and whom you have represented as no fool, be at the same time such a confused, pudding-headed, muddle-headed, fellow, as go look? So, Sir Critic, I could have replied, but I scorn it. 'Tis language unurbane, and only befitting the man who cannot give clear and satisfactory accounts of things, or dive deep enough into the first causes of human ignorance and confusion. It is moreover the reply valiant and therefore I reject it, for though it might have suited my Uncle Toby's character as a soldier excellently well, and had he not accustomed himself, in such attacks, to whistle the lillibullero, as he wanted no courage, 'tis the very answer he would have given, yet it would by no means have done for me. You see as plain as can be, that I write as a man of erudition, that even my similes, my allusions, my illustrations, my metaphors, are erudite, and that I must sustain my character properly, and contrast it properly too, else what would become of me? Why, sir, I should be undone, at this very moment that I am going here to fill up one place against a critic, I should have made an opening for a couple. Therefore I answer thus. Pray, sir, in all the reading which you have ever read, did you ever read such a book as Locke's Essay upon the Human Understanding? Don't answer me rashly because many, I know, quote the book, who have not read it and many have read it who understand it not. If either of these is your case, as I write to instruct, I will tell you in three words what the book is. It is a history. A history. Of who? What? Where? When? Don't hurry yourself, it is a history book, sir, which may possibly recommend it to the world, of what passes in a man's own mind, and if you will say so much of the book, and no more, believe me, you will cut no contemptible figure in a metaphysic circle. But this by the way. Now if you will venture to go along with me, and look down into the bottom of this matter, it will be found that the cause of obscurity and confusion, in the mind of a man, is threefold. Dull organs, dear sir, in the first place. Secondly, slight and transient impressions made by the objects, when the said organs are not dull. And thirdly, a memory like unto a sieve, not able to retain what it has received. Call down Dolly your chambermaid, and I will give you my cap and bell along with it, if I make not this matter so plain that Dolly herself should understand it as well as Moll Branch. When Dolly has indited her epistle to Robin, and has thrust her arm into the bottom of her pocket hanging by her right side, take that opportunity to recollect that the organs and faculties of perception can, by nothing in this world, be so aptly typified and explained as by that one thing which Dolly's hand is in search of. Your organs are not so dull that I should inform you 'tis an inch, sir, of red seal wax. When this is melted and dropped upon the letter, if Dolly fumbles too long for her thimble, till the wax is overhardened, it will not receive the mark of her thimble from the usual impulse which was wont to imprint it. Very well. If Dolly's wax, for want of better, is beeswax, or of a temper too soft, though it may receive, it will not hold the impression, how hard soever Dolly thrusts against it, and last of all, supposing the wax good, and eke the thimble, but applied thereto in careless haste, as her mistress rings the bell, in any one of these three cases the print left by the thimble will be as unlike the prototype as a brass jack. Now you must understand that not one of these was the true cause of the confusion in my Uncle Toby's discourse, and it is for that very reason I enlarge upon them so long, after the manner of great physiologists to show the world, what it did not arise from. What it did arise from, I have hinted above, and a fertile source of obscurity it is, and ever will be, and that is the unsteady uses of words, which have perplexed the clearest and most exalted understandings. It is 10-1, at Arthur's, whether you have ever read the literary histories of past ages, if you have, what terrible battles, yclept logomachies, Have they occasioned and perpetuated with so much gall and ink shed, that a good-natured man cannot read the accounts of them without tears in his eyes? Gentle critic, when thou hast weighed all this, and considered within thyself how much of thy own knowledge, discourse, and conversation has been pestered and disordered, at one time or other, by this, and this only, what a putter and racket in councils about Greek, and in the schools of the learned about power and about spirit, about essences, and about quintessences, about substances, and about space. What confusion in greater theaters from words of little meaning, and as indeterminate a sense. When thou considerest this, thou wilt not wonder at my uncle Toby's perplexities, thou wilt drop a tear of pity upon his scarp and his counter-scarp, his glassy and his covered way, his ravelin and his half-moon. 'Twas not by ideas, by heaven, his life was put in jeopardy by words. 8 Chapter 1. 28. When my uncle Toby got his map of Namur to his mind, he began immediately to apply himself, and with the utmost diligence, to the study of it, for nothing being of more importance to him than his recovery, and his recovery depending, as you have read, upon the passions and affections of his mind, it behoved him to take the nicest care to make himself so far master of his subject, as to be able to talk upon it without emotion. In a fortnight's close and painful application, which, by the by, did my uncle Toby's wound, upon his groin, no good, he was enabled, by the help of some marginal documents at the feet of the elephant, together with Gobesius's military architecture and pyrobology, translated from the Flemish, to form his discourse with passable perspicuity, and before he was 2 full months gone, he was right eloquent upon it, and could make not only the attack of the advanced counterscarp with great order, but having, by that time, gone much deeper into the art, than what his first motive made necessary, my uncle Toby was able to cross the Mice and Sambra, make diversions as far as Vauban's line, the Abbey of Salsines, and see, and give his visitors as distinct a history of each of their attacks, as of that of the gate of St. Nicholas, where he had the honor to receive his wound. But desire of knowledge, like the thirst of riches, increases ever with the acquisition of it. The more my uncle Toby pored over his map, the more he took a liking to it. By the same process and electrical assimilation, as I told you, through which I ween the souls of connoisseurs themselves, by long friction and incumbition, have the happiness, at length, to get all bevertued, be pictured, be butterflied, and be fiddled. The more my uncle Toby drank of this sweet fountain of science, the greater was the heat and impatience of his thirst, so that before the first year of his confinement had well gone round, there was scarce a fortified town in Italy or Flanders, of which, by one means or other, he had not procured a plan, reading over as he got them, and carefully collating therewith the histories of their sieges, their demolitions, their improvements, and new works, all which he would read with that intense application and delight, that he would forget himself, his wound, his confinement, his dinner. In the second year my uncle Toby purchased Remelli and Cataneo, translated from the Italian, likewise Stevinus, Morales, the Chevalier de Ville, Lorny, Cockhorn, Sheeter, the Count de Pagan, the Marshal Vauban, Mons. Blondel, with almost as many more books of military architecture, as Don Quixote was found to have of chivalry, when the curate and barber invaded his library. Towards the beginning of the third year, which was in August, 99, my uncle Toby found it necessary to understand a little of projectiles, and having judged it best to draw his knowledge from the fountainhead, he began with Entartaglia, who it seems was the first man who detected the imposition of a cannonball's doing all that mischief under the notion of a right line. This Entartaglia proved to my uncle Toby to be an impossible thing. Endless is the search of truth. No sooner was my uncle Toby satisfied which road the cannonball did not go, but he was insensibly led on, and resolved in his mind to inquire and find out which road the ball did go, for which purpose he was obliged to set off afresh with old Malthus, and studied him devoutly. He proceeded next to Galileo and Torricellius, wherein, by certain geometrical rules, infallibly laid down, he found the precise path to be a parabola or else an hyperbola, and that the parameter, or latus rectum, of the conic section of the said path, was to the quantity and amplitude in a direct ratio, as the whole line to the sine of double the angle of incidence, formed by the breach upon an horizontal plane, and that the semi-perimeter, stop. My dear Uncle Toby, stop. Go not 1 foot farther into this thorny and bewildered track. Intricate are the steps. Intricate are the mazes of this labyrinth. Intricate are the troubles which the pursuit of this bewitching phantom knowledge will bring upon thee. O my uncle, fly, fly, fly from it as from a serpent. Is it fit, good-natured man, thou shouldst sit up, with the wound upon thy groin, whole nights baking thy blood with hectic watchings? Alas! Twill exasperate thy symptoms, check thy perspirations, evaporate thy spirits, waste thy animal strength, dry up thy radical moisture, bring thee into a costive habit of body, impair thy health, and hasten all the infirmities of thy old age. O my uncle! My uncle Toby, 9 chapter 1. 29. I would not give a groat for that man's knowledge and pen craft, who does not understand this, that the best plain narrative in the world, tacked very close to the last spirited apostrophe to my uncle Toby, would have felt both cold and vapid upon the reader's palate. Therefore I forthwith put an end to the chapter, though I was in the middle of my story. Writers of my stamp have one principle in common with painters. Where an exact copying makes our pictures less striking, we choose the less evil, deeming it even more pardonable to trespass against truth than beauty. This is to be understood cum grano salis, but be it as it will, as the parallel is made more for the sake of letting the apostrophe cool than anything else, 'tis not very material whether upon any other score the reader approves of it or not. In the latter end of the third year, my uncle Toby, perceiving that the parameter and semi-parameter of the conic section angered his wound, he left off the study of projectiles in a kind of a huff, and betook himself to the practical part of fortification only, the pleasure of which, like a spring held back, returned upon him with redoubled force. It was in this year that my uncle began to break in upon the daily regularity of a clean shirt, to dismiss his barber unshaven, and to allow his surgeon scarce time sufficient to dress his wound, concerning himself so little about it, as not to ask him once in seven times dressing, how it went on, when, lo, all of a sudden, for the change was quick as lightning, he began to sigh heavily for his recovery, complained to my father, grew impatient with the surgeon, and one morning, as he heard his foot coming upstairs, he shut up his books, and thrust aside his instruments, in order to expostulate with him upon the protraction of the cure, which, he told him, might surely have been accomplished at least by that time. He dwelt long upon the miseries he had undergone, and the sorrows of his 4 years' melancholy imprisonment, adding, that had it not been for the kind looks and fraternal cheerings of the best of brothers, he had long since sunk under his misfortunes. My father was by. My uncle Toby's eloquence brought tears into his eyes. 'Twas unexpected. My uncle Toby, by nature, was not eloquent. It had the greater effect. The surgeon was confounded, not that there wanted grounds for such, or greater marks of impatience, but 'twas unexpected too. In the 4 years he had attended him, he had never seen anything like it in my uncle Toby's carriage. He had never once dropped one fretful or discontented word. He had been all patience, all submission. We lose the right of complaining sometimes by forbearing it, but we often treble the force. The surgeon was astonished, but much more so, when he heard my uncle Toby go on, and peremptorily insist upon his healing up the wound directly, or sending for Monsieur Rognat, the king's sergeant surgeon, to do it for him. The desire of life and health is implanted in man's nature. The love of liberty and enlargement is a sister passion to it. These my uncle Toby had in common with his species, and either of them had been sufficient to account for his earnest desire to get well and out of doors. But I have told you before, that nothing wrought with our family after the common way, and from the time and manner in which this eager desire showed itself in the present case, the penetrating reader will suspect there was some other cause or crotchet for it in my uncle Toby's head. There was so, and 'tis the subject of the next chapter to set forth what that cause and crotchet was. I own, when that's done, 'twill be time to return back to the parlor fireside, where we left my uncle Toby in the middle of his sentence. 0 Chapter 1. 30. When a man gives himself up to the government of a ruling passion, or, in other words, when his hobby horse grows headstrong, farewell cool reason and fair discretion. My uncle Toby's wound was near well, and as soon as the surgeon recovered his surprise, and could get leave to say as much, he told him, 'twas just beginning to incarnate, and that if no fresh exfoliation happened, which there was no sign of, it would be dried up in 5 or 6 weeks. The sound of as many Olympiads, 12 hours before, would have conveyed an idea of shorter duration to my uncle Toby's mind. The succession of his ideas was now rapid. He broiled with impatience to put his design in execution, and so, without consulting farther with any soul living, which, by the by, I think is right, when you are predetermined to take no one soul's advice, he privately ordered Trim, his man, to pack up a bundle of lint and dressings, and hire a chariot and four to be at the door exactly by 12 o'clock that day, when he knew my father would be upon change. So leaving a banknote upon the table for the surgeon's care of him, and a letter of tender thanks for his brothers, he packed up his maps, his books of fortification, his instruments, and see. And by the help of a crutch on one side, and Trim on the other, my uncle Toby embarked for Shandy Hall. The reason, or rather the rise of this sudden demigration, was as follows. the table in my Uncle Toby's room, and at which, the night before this change happened, he was sitting with his maps, and see. About him being somewhat of the smallest, for that infinity of great and small instruments of knowledge which usually lay crowded upon it, he had the accident, in reaching over for his tobacco box, to throw down his compasses, and in stooping to take the compasses up, with his sleeve he threw down his case of instruments and snuffers, and as the dice took a run against him, in his endeavoring to catch the snuffers in falling, he thrust Monsieur Blondel off the table, and Count de Pagan atop of him. 'Twas to no purpose for a man, lame as my Uncle Toby was, to think of redressing these evils by himself. He rung his bell for his man. "Trim, Trim," quoth my Uncle Toby, "prithee see what confusion I have here been making. I must have some better contrivance. Trim, canst not thou take my rule, and measure the length and breadth of this table, and then go and bespeak me one as big again?"
"Yes, and please your honor," replied Trim, making a bow, "but I hope your honor will be soon well enough to get down to your country seat, where, as your honor takes so much pleasure in fortification, we could manage this matter to a T. I must here inform you, that this servant of my Uncle Toby's, who went by the name of Trim, had been a corporal in my uncle's own company. His real name was James Butler, but having got the nickname of Trim, in the regiment, my Uncle Toby, unless when he happened to be very angry with him, would never call him by any other name. The poor fellow had been disabled for the service, by a wound on his left knee by a musket bullet, at the Battle of London, which was 2 years before the affair of Namur, and as the fellow was well beloved in the regiment, and a handy fellow into the bargain, my Uncle Toby took him for his servant, and of an excellent use was he, attending my Uncle Toby in the camp and in his quarters as a valet, groom, barber, cook, sempster, and nurse, and indeed, from first to last, waited upon him and served him with great fidelity and affection. My Uncle Toby loved the man in return, and what attached him more to him still, was the similitude of their knowledge. For Corporal Trim, for so, for the future, I shall call him, by 4 years' occasional attention to his master's discourse upon fortified towns, and the advantage of prying and peeping continually into his master's plans, and see. Exclusive and besides what he gained hobby-horsically, as a body servant, non-hobby-horsical per se, had become no mean proficient in the science, and was thought, by the cook and chambermaid, to know as much of the nature of strongholds as my Uncle Toby himself. I have but one more stroke to give to finish Corporal Trim's character, and it is the only dark line in it. The fellow loved to advise, or rather to hear himself talk. His carriage, however, was so perfectly respectful, 'twas easy to keep him silent when you had him so, but set his tongue a-going, you had no hold of him, he was voluble,